are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, September 6, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks, but we're, are we breaking format a little bit? Maybe a little bit. Not a huge week in the news, beyond, of course, Hurricane Dorian and Sharpie Gate. But there was also a really important 8 hours worth of climate forum two nights ago. And Dave Roberts of Vox, formerly of Grist, will be on the program to break down that climate town hall. And in the wake of Dorian, the Bahamas are shattered. Along with, it appears, Donald Trump's sanity. New York AG is investigating Facebook for antitrust violations. Jerry Nadler and the Judiciary Committee subpoena Homeland Security for documents related to Trump's offering pardons to custom officials who break the law. Meanwhile, Andrew Cuomo has a plan to screw all of us. Biden's New York fundraiser with a natural gas executive protested by climate activists. Howard Schultz, ladies and gentlemen, sadly, is no longer running for president. Also, I should tell you, Howard Schultz was running for president. Farm loan delinquencies rise nationally and surge in the battleground state of Wisconsin. And never again, protesters slam Amazon for its services to ICE and Palantir. This time in Massachusetts, 12 arrested in Cambridge. And Republicans protect Trump by actually canceling multiple primaries across the country.
It's rigged, folks.
Total rig job. Lastly, Jacob Wall, conservative slash grifter, or maybe, do I really, is that, am I being redundant?
He might be, and he also might be next level.
Charged with a felony in California. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We will get to all of it. Everyone is in the house. Jamie is back in the fold, as it were.
Here I am, returned from my desert journey down the hallways of always.
You definitely have, like, there's a quality to your voice that sounds like you've been on extended vacation. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It came to our attention that the Hannity clip that we've been talking about, somehow we didn't get it in there. It ended up being, what was, Cy Hirsch? I don't know. Yeah, exactly. At least you have the good sense to give yourself a... So
we should just play that every time Sam asks for anything.
For members, we will post that this weekend. So you don't have to do anything. It'll be in your members feed. And we'll just title it the Deep Archive Clip of the Week, which I think we may start doing for members. We're just going to pick a Deep Archive clip randomly. Maybe we should just do it randomly.
Or could do it chronologically. Just pick this is the best one from the first couple of months. Or
yeah, we could do that too. I just don't know if we have it broken down. I don't know if we have it written out in the documents. But we will start doing that on a weekly basis. Just drop one, I don't know, 20-minute clip or something like that, just for you to walk down memory lane. And you can participate in that by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. So let's talk. I know that Michael did some clips from the town hall yesterday, but still have a couple more. By all accounts, this was a really good 7 hours, 8 hours of policy discussion. And we'll talk more with Dave Roberts about it, who's been crying for something like this for a long time. And there was a lot of things that came out of it, not the least of which is that, I mean, it would be impossible to imagine that you could find two or three Republicans to have a policy discussion on just about anything that lasts this long. Never mind, you know, 8 or 10 solid contributions. However, what has come out of this, whether you read the Washington Post or the New York Times or Huffington Post or whatever it is that Joe Biden really was the only one who seemed to show up without any depth. Apparently Kamala Harris, I didn't see hers, but from what I've read, wasn't particularly impressive on this
not
score.
Not depthful.
But Cory Booker apparently was quite good. Buttigieg was quite good. And of course, Sanders and Warren also got, I think, the biggest plaudits, as it were. And Jay Inslee, who wasn't even there, got a big, a lot of people tipped his hat. But like I say, Joe Biden seemed to have basically approached this like he's approached everything in terms of issues, which is, I don't really need to talk about the issues. I can talk around them and of them and about how important they are, but I don't really need to address anything. And sometimes when you do that, it sounds like jibber jabber.
First of all, we have to do is go back and turn back all the changes that, in fact, the president has made, from CAFE standards to moving in a direction that we, in fact, deal with providing people who get displaced opportunities to have jobs.
Pause
by
it.
Sending them.
So, first of all, the CAFE standards that he's tried to roll back, that Trump has from the Obama era, it looks like that may be a non-starter because California is basically creating its own CAFE standards and the car makers themselves don't want to roll it back. But yes, of course, first thing you should do is try and undo the damage. But he can't even go through any of the proposals that Donald Trump has implemented, whether it's like pulling off the restrictions and regulations on how much methane can leak through fracking, how much coal-fired power plants can put CO2. I mean, things off the top of my head that I can list, and I'm not running for president. But here we go.
Have jobs by sending them back to school, by doing continuing education, whole range of things. I would see to it in the firm immediately moving toward, you know, we are in fact in a position now that if in fact we dealt with mitigation across the board, just what we did in the last administration and before, leading to a standard that we provide efficiency for appliances.
So apparently
you're confused by that.
Apparently. Well, no, I actually understood everything he was saying, but it was nothing.
I mean, all environmental problems have been generated post 2016 he's saying.
No, he's just simply saying we can go with general. He is saying the biggest amount of pablum. We got to get involved in mitigation.
Right.
Now, he knows that we got to mitigate something. He's just not sure exactly what it is specifically we're supposed to mitigate. So, of course, the thing to do is efficient appliances, which has been something that you have said for anyone would have said for the past 30 years. The idea of Energy Star appliances came out decades ago. This is a guy who said, I've got this climate forum The advisor said, hey, Joe, we got to go over this. I got it. I got it. I don't need to know the details. Go ahead.
Right now, these people right here. Look, it's a little bit like a whole lot of things that people didn't know before this guy became president until he started to take it away. And they started to take it away and he said, whoa, wait a minute, man. Look what that's done. He's changed the CAFE standards. We're not going to meet those standards. Well, that means boom. He's done this. It means bang. Everybody knows now, knows what he has done, and it's raised the ante.
So this is where he's saying that, like, oh, the stakes are higher now because we see that Donald Trump hasn't done, has reversed. And again, the CAFE standards have not been changed at this point. He's proposed it, and hopefully it won't go through. But there's this sense in Joe Biden's mind that climate change was not a problem 3 years ago and that people are aware of it now because of Donald Trump has reversed this stuff because Joe Biden didn't pay attention to this 3 years ago. And he didn't pay attention to it 5 years ago. And it doesn't appear that he paid attention to it in the hours leading up to this forum. It's stunning. It's stunning. It's scary.
Is it really?
It's
stunning,
so
though?
Cringy.
It is.
Like, no, I almost feel bad for him, but I think I'm going to save that for when he's not doing so well in the polls.
Yeah, I would save.
Definitely save that. Oh my God, Joe's bleeding on stage.
Right,
he's bleeding. His eyes are bleeding. It's disgusting. Isn't it disgusting?
So gross.
So gross. So disrespectful.
Details are irrelevant.
Should worry about your own emissions,
this is,
Joe.
I mean, this should be a real. I just don't understand how anybody who is serious about politics looks at this guy and says, "A, that he is up to a campaign." I mean, it's scary from the perspective of you want your candidates to realize what's the most urgent issue that exists. Or even the top three, if you're somehow like, well, we'll figure it out. And even if you're someone who believes that, like, okay, he'll find people who will deal with it. He'll appoint a VP. You know, Jay Inslee will be his VP or
best
something.
People.
The problem is that he doesn't feel like he has to prepare for stuff. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. And, this is an important election, and you.
Oh, but the details are irrelevant.
Oh my God.
Exactly.
I mean, hey,
this is an important election, and you don't want somebody whose estimation of themselves is so out of line with what their ability to deliver is.
Dark thought, though, it worked for Trump.
It certainly did work for Trump. I don't think he has Donald Trump's the same base of support.
Yeah,
frankly.
Really has my swag. Please.
We have the best people.
Please. Oh, my God. This guy's
I
bleeding.
Actually think it was the opposite with Trump, too. I think Trump thought, I'm not going to win. I'm in this for something else. But
Biden's
who knows what
to,
goes
you don't
that
know that
orange
Biden's
head
trying
is.
To create an alternative to MSNBC?
Right.
You didn't hear about that? God, the whole plan
Biden
is
TV.
MSNBC. Biden TV,
no,
the Biden network.
He's creating
a
perfect synthesis of
it's a new
Trump
scam with his brother.
Yeah, it's the latest.
Yeah, it's the latest Biden family scam.
Folks, support for today's show comes from The New Yorker. The New Yorker represents the best writing in America today. It's literally one of those ads. When The New Yorker said they were going to advertise with us, I was excited about that. And why? Because I've obviously been reading The New Yorker for, well, decades. Many of you have, I'm sure, have been reading The New Yorker for decades. There's all sorts of writing in there. Doreen St. Felix, she's a staff writer at The New Yorker, who covers the highs and lows of today's culture. 2019, she won an Ellie Award for columns and commentary. John Cassidy, who covers politics and economics for The New Yorker. He's written on articles that range from intelligence failures before the Iraq War to the economics of Keynes. We have writers from The New Yorker on this program. Very often stories in The New Yorker are sources for stories that we talk about. You head over there right now and you can check out stuff that will explain to you, like, what's going on in Britain. I can't, but they've written about it. There's multiple stuff, letters from the UK, stories about, you know, the Walmart's decision and the other big box stores' decision not to sell guns and what that means. Stories by Jeffrey Toobin about the implications for the emoluments clause with Trump's offer to host the G7. And now you can get 12 weeks of a subscription to The New Yorker for just $6. Plus, you get the New Yorker tote bag, weekly home delivery of the print edition, and unlimited access to NewYorker.com, which has 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. When you go to NewYorker.com/majority, enter the code MAJORITY. You'll also have access to the apps, the online archive, crossword puzzle, and more. Check it out. It's NewYorker.com/majority. Enter the code MAJORITY. Save 50% on a 12-week subscription and get the exclusive tote. Do it now. Great opportunity, honestly. And, folks, nobody knows the hassle of doing a small business more than I do. Well, I'm sure there are people who do, but I certainly am aware of the hassles of it. You've got payroll. You've got, we've all got to do the, we've got to do like HR stuff. We got to do that, that online sexual harassment thing too. We have to do. Have you gotten those emails from my sister?
Yes.
But it's difficult because you have one system for accounting. You have another one for sales. You have another one for inventory. It's just a big inefficient mess that takes too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. And well, folks, for those of you who have small businesses or big businesses, NetSuite by Oracle. It's the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, gives you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, you save money, and perhaps most importantly to someone like myself, unneeded headaches. You manage your sales, your finance, and your accounting, your orders, and your human resources instantly right from your desktop or your phone. So if I played golf, I could go do all that stuff from there. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/majority. That's netsuite.com/majority to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/majority. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Dave Roberts.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor, and I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take. It must have fell when I lost my mind. Deep in the cup, drowning in pain. Somebody help, cause I can't find my way. Nobody move. Ooh.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining us again, and welcome back to the show. He writes for climate, politics, and for Vox, which is, of course, basically where we are this week. Dave Roberts, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam.
All right, let's. I want to start with this. You know, as we review this, because this is it's been a relatively slow news week, except for a massive disaster essentially to hit the Bahamas. One where, when you listen to what people were saying there, they, you know, the Bahamas had very good building codes. They were built to withstand hurricanes, mm-hmm. and they basically just said, like, this is something that we couldn't have imagined. You know, and this seems to me to be the first hurricane that has been more or less, at least in the circles that one could imagine, unequivocally reported as a function of climate change. Is that your observation as well?
Well, that's not, you know, it depends on the media you're looking at. I wouldn't call that universal yet, but I would say that, yeah, it's been a rapid phase shift in media coverage of these things. And yeah, I'd say that Dorian is one of the first that's, you know, there's more like, this is what climate change looks like, and less, you know, let's have a 800 word thumb sucker on whether we're allowed to say this is about climate change or not. You know what I mean? Like, right. There's more confidence.
I wonder if part of that too is a function of like that, because it was the Bahamas, right? As opposed to, say, like, I don't know, you know,
Alabama.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if it's because that there is, like, you know, well, there's a lot of money that is involved in the Bahamas. There's a lot of, like, I feel like, you know, East Coast media people all went to the Bahamas at one point in their lives. You know what I mean? It just seems like, you know, I would watch TV and people saying, like, I know this island or something to that effect. But the tenor of it really, really struck me this week.
Yeah. And I think we're seeing this, not just with this hurricane, but in general, we're seeing more and more of these sort of disasters and, you know, heat waves and flooding, everything strike places that are relatively wealthy, so that when the type of people who watch, you know, cable news see it, they're like, oh, those look like me. Those are people who look like me. And it, I don't have to tell you, any problem in our society, once it reaches, you know, wealthy upper middle class white people, and they realize that they can't stop it and that they're helpless before it, then I think you're going to see politics start to shift pretty rapidly in the wake of that.
So you back, I think it was in July, had written a piece about anticipating the climate town halls that were going to happen. You had a bunch of questions, and I want to talk to you about mm-hmm. that, and maybe use that as a guide as to assess, you know, what we heard, I guess, 2 days ago now. But you basically broke it down to two premises, which I thought were really interesting. I mean, particularly the second. I mean, the first one is, you know, the candidates, we should be talking about, like, you know, what can they actually do as president, given the fact that Republicans will still exist, assuming that.
Right.
But let's talk about the second one first, because you write, the second premise to some of your questions was that climate science is peripheral, not central, to climate politics. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is sort of climate change kind of was discovered or grew out of science. It came directly out of the science community, and it was always scientists who were way earlier than other people in you know, raising these warnings and communicating about it. So the whole issue has just been shaped from the very beginning by the kind of instincts and preferences and rhetorical styles and sort of assumptions about cognition and rationality that are common among the scientific community. And you know, God bless climate scientists, truly, but in my experience at least, people in the hard sciences are not necessarily the most adept at communication. And what they want to believe, what they think and believe way down deep in their hearts beneath reason, is that people come to their views by gathering evidence and assessing it and drawing conclusions. And they just have this faith that if you can convince people of the scientific truth of this thing, that the rest will follow, that they will sort of update their political assumptions and update their political preferences accordingly based on this new information. And of course, like anyone who's studied political communication or social sciences or spoken with a lot of human beings knows that that's not really how people operate. That's not how people come to their views. It's definitely not how people come to their views in politics. So my whole point is just what people are concerned about, average people out in the country, about climate changes. How's it going to affect me? And how are the solutions going to affect me? Like, am I going to have to pay more money? Am I going to face a heat wave? And who's for this and who's against it? What does it mean? Like, what does it mean culturally about our way of life and about America? Like, how do I fit this into my worldview? And it's just not that's just not a scientific process. They're not building, you know, they're not starting at physics and building up. That's just not how people think. So the whole discussion has just been kind of stuck, mired in science, which just puts a lot of people off for years and years and years. And I think it's just time for Democrats to start talking about the social aspects of this and the policy and the kind of economic ripple effect and the sort of transformation of the country. Like, these are not abstract scientific things. These are very much tangible, on the ground shifts in the way we live. And that's what people need to hear about and be comforted about and be given a way to think about. And like, science just doesn't really help with that.
And so, in other words, it's like the scientific issues are, the sort of the O's and ones under the matrix, but how it implicates, how it affects us as human beings is a very different way. And at one point you said basically the questions should focus on how to shift the balance of power, because it's power, not science, that's primarily at issue.
Yes, it's power at issue. And especially, I mean, one of the ways this scientism kind of reflects is this obsession among climate people to this day with deniers. You know, you hear about this all the time. Like, how do we convince the deniers? How do we persuade the deniers? And my whole point is just that none of those people, 0% of those people came to that conclusion by assessing the scientific results, right? That's what their tribe believes. So that's what they believe. And then they go out and find arguments to justify that. So it's not, the arguments are sort of beside the point. Shift the balance of power, the balance of interests, make it in Republican interests to act on this. And then Republican leaders will change. And then you'll see Republican media start to change. And then you'll see the Republican base, as they tend to, like a school of fish, just switch direction and accept the science and take some other stance. Like, they don't, you know, it didn't come out of the science, so they're not going to have any trouble changing their views about the science. The science basically peripheral, as I said.
We just need to figure out how to make the idea of climate change like the idea of the deficit for Republicans, essentially, and just watch the problems melt away. All right. Well, so let's go through some of these questions that you wanted to present and give me a sense of like who you thought. Well, why don't we start with this? I mean, because I read your piece about who the winners and losers were in the this forum. Give me your sense. Give me your overall sense, and then we'll go through some of the more specific questions.
Sure. Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, as we've discovered this morning, it's not going to be a ratings extravaganza to have 7 hours of sort of calm and relatively detailed policy discussion. But I went into this, you know, Sam, I'm a little cynical, and I'm especially, believe it or not, a little cynical about cable news. So I just expected the worst. I expected nonstop kind of shallow, gimmicky gotcha questions, the kind that cable moderators tend to ask. And then I expected just a sort of fusillade of cliches from the candidates about, you know, this is an existential problem and Congress must act. And just that for 7 hours, I fully expected to be bored to tears. But I was, I got to say, like, I got to give CNN credit for this. That's why we put CNN on our list of winners. Like, there were some goofy moderator questions here and there, but by and large, they maintained an incredible level of seriousness and substance for 7 hours, which is no small thing. Like, the audience questions were just amazing. Like, I absolutely could not have done better. Like, time and again, I was just set back by the how sort of articulate and well-phrased the questions from the audience were, and phrased in such a way, and this is something that cable moderators can't seem to ever do, but phrased in such a way as to be substantive enough that they couldn't be dodged. You know what I mean? Like, specific, like, what is your policy about this particularly? Just really good, tough questions. It was sort of an interesting contrast. Like, you know, Wolf Blitzer would ask some goofball Wolf Blitzer question, and then they would cut to the audience.
It would be Blitzer, hyper articulate,
amazing question.
Blitzer at one point asked, I think, was pressing Pete Buttigieg, will everyone have to have electric cars?
And it was Andrew Yang.
Andrew Yang. Yeah,
and
okay.
Andrew Yang, of course, had the normal response, which is, what do you mean have to? They're awesome. Like, they're so much better. But Wolf Blitzer's like, have to? Do we have to? Like this in Wolf Blitzer's tea brain is a tough question. Like, respond to this Republican framing, right? Respond to this GOP framing. That's what cable moderators think is a tough question. And the contrast with the audience that was asking, like, legitimately, substantively tough questions was so glaring at one point. It almost seemed to me like CNN was, like, making fun of itself almost, or, like, clowning itself, like, with a wink almost, because you cut back and forth between Wolf Blitzer and the audience, and you start to think, like, why is Wolf there? Like, these people are so much better at this job than he is. Like, just get him off the stage.
All right. Well, so CNN.
But overall, it was great. My point is, overall, it was 1,000 times better than I expected.
All right. Well, so let's start with your first the first question that you had, you know, talked about in terms of in this one. I mean, this is a pretty broad. I always say it's a question that basically addresses sort of a very fundamental point that has nothing to do per se with the policies, but rather how they're going to get done. Your first question that you had sort of talked about back in July was, it's conventional wisdom that says that only a president has only 100 days or so in which to pass a few key priorities before backlash in the next round of elections take over. In 2008, Democrats decided to put healthcare first, then climate never got done. Where does climate change fall on your list of priorities when you step into office? Give me your sense of how who and if you want to just focus on some of the top tier candidates, that's fine. In terms of, like, whose response was the most convincing to you or resonated or problematic?
Well, you know, there's only so much you can really tell from what they say in response to questions like that. Like, it's a good question, but there's no way to force them to give good answers. So of course, all of them said the right thing, which is, this is an existential problem. It's a top priority. I'm going to focus on it the minute I walk into office. The two people whose answers sort of, well, there were three answers that jumped out at me. One is Booker. Booker was the last candidate to go, and he was up in hour 7. So I was, like, at that point fried and expecting very little, but Booker put in one of the strongest performances I've seen from him in the campaign yet. Like, by the time he was done, I was just thinking, like, where the hell has this guy been? Like, this is, you know, why haven't we seen this guy before? Anyway, he was fantastic. But what he said was, and I think this is the correct answer, is it's not just that I'm going to put climate on a list of priorities. It's that everything I do in office is going to be done through this lens, right? So, like, climate is going to be part of foreign policy. It's going to be part of economic policy. You know, it's part of all policy. It's not one item among many. It's an overriding concern. And I thought that got at the substance better than anybody else. I think that's sort of like the correct answer. It's not an item on a list. It's a background condition for all other things. So that was good. Warren, I think, I believed her because she sort of was, I guess, brave enough to say, no, it will not be my number one focus. My number one focus, and she said this a million times on the trail, very consistently, my number one focus is corruption, right? The minute I get in, we need to address, voting rights and money in politics and all these sort of these things that stand in the way of getting anything else done, right? And so she said, like, that will be a climate policy. It will be an all kinds of policy, right? It'll enable any other policy to happen. But you know, I thought saying that to this crowd was, at least somewhat brave. And then the other one, which was interesting to me, was someone directly asked, speaking of power, you know, and how to use power, someone directly asked Bernie whether he would support getting rid of the filibuster, which is, of course, a huge question that looms around this and any other, you know, in healthcare and anything else. Like, if it takes 60 votes to pass, it's not going to pass. And if Mitch McConnell has the power to block it, he's going to block it. We all know this by now. I hope everyone knows this by now. So it's really hard to see how any of this happens without the filibuster. And Bernie gave this sort of, for the most part, Bernie was really good in this forum. He was also as good as I've ever seen him. But in this answer, it was just kind of some sort of mumbly, half-hearted defense of the filibuster. He said he doesn't want the Senate to become the House. But then he claimed he would pass his entire climate package through budget reconciliation. And I don't know, like, how nerdy you've gotten on that subject, but it's just
people know here that budget reconciliation is sort of like an omnibus thing where you can pass legislation. It's an exception to the rules of the House and the Senate where you can pass legislation that directly impacts the amount of money, the budget, the money that that either comes in or goes out.
Right.
And certainly some of, I would imagine some, or maybe a large part. Right.
It's a pretty small sliver. Like these climate plans, these candidates are putting forward, including Bernie, are sweeping, and they have lots of regulatory pieces that would not traditionally fit in budget reconciliation rules. So Bernie's theory of the case is, you know, the vice president oversees the Senate. He's just going to have his vice president say, screw that. We can pass anything through reconciliation, which would be just a grotesque violation of Senate procedure, just a really flagrant violation of Senate procedure with no real justification. And my whole point is just that if you're willing to do that, like, that seems like fuckery on a scale even beyond just getting rid of the filibuster. So why don't you just get rid of the filibuster? So either Bernie has a weird and sort of self-contradictory theory of change, or what I suspect is just that he doesn't want to say what he really thinks about the filibuster unless he wins.
Yeah, that has been a vexing question for me for a long time, and I tend to lean towards the second theory that he's thinking, well, if you know, probably best to wait to that bridge till we come to it, because you know, one time, you know, you don't know. First of all, you don't know if the Democrats are going to take the Senate. And so yes. Probably.
And also I've heard, not to get too far off onto this, but I've heard from people on the Hill that there are a few Democratic constituencies, most notably, I think, Planned Parenthood, the sort of abortion movement, that basically believes without the filibuster, abortion is doomed in the U.S. over some time period. And so they're very much against that whole notion. So I think you're hearing more and more talk about a single exception to the filibuster. Like you said, I think Bennett, floated this. I've seen a couple of people float it sort of like, you know, I think the filibuster is important, but for some issues, you know, when it comes to climate change, you know, we'll have the Senate do a sort of one-time exception. I think that's trying to kind of address Planned Parenthood and try to find a way through this dilemma.
Okay, and so your first two questions dealt with, actually, the second one dealt with the filibuster. that you, and this is obviously from back in July, and that is a big issue. So let's, then
Harris, weirdly, Harris, just as a side note here, Harris of all people, just sort of blurted out, opposition to the filibuster kind of in the middle of her comments. And as far as I know, she has not been out front about that. She had kind of one of the strongest anti-filibuster statements of the whole evening. I found that kind of odd.
Interesting. Well, I mean, this is, you know, that there's two parts of this, right? And that is like, what are your plans and how ambitious they are? And I want to get to that in a moment. But your first three questions deal with basically the three questions deal with this sort of notion of like, okay, let's take just a baseline assumption of what your plans are. How are you going to actually implement these? The third question you had after that filibuster question was, assuming there's no way for you to pass this legislation with or without the filibuster because Republicans control one of the houses of Congress, what executive actions are you prepared to take to reduce carbon emissions? Did you have a sense that, I mean, we played a clip of Biden. And I must admit, I didn't see much of Biden's stuff at all. But we played a couple of clips of Biden where it
was not good.
it struck me as a guy who's like, his policy people said, hey, Joe, let's sit down and crunch this stuff. And he just says, like, I got this. I've been talking about this stuff for 30 years. We need better refrigerators. You know, and it sort of felt like he went out there and did this. But was there any other of the candidates who basically said, here's what my legislative agenda would be. Here is my backup executive order agenda, or here's what we've determined I could do by executive order. Was anybody that granular?
Yeah. I mean, almost all of them have that stuff in their plans, right? Almost all of them have an extensive sort of list of executive actions they could undertake in their climate plans. It's a little bit tricky. The politics of it are a little bit tricky because if you start talking about these things, these are, you know, what you can do with the executive branch is fairly incremental and sort of like, you know, it's what Obama was doing, basically. It's a return to what Obama was doing, which is sort of like not nothing, but fiddling on the margins relative to what's needed. So when candidates are talking about it, it sounds, I think, to primary voters and to climate activists like they're being weenies, like they're talking about incrementalism, they're talking about centrism, they're talking about going back to Obama. So they, you know, people, I don't think voters really like to hear about it very much, but I think all the candidates are extremely cognizant of the fact that it's a very likely outcome, right? That's all they're able to do. So like Klobuchar has went through a chapter and verse of what she would do. She has a good section on that. And Inslee had a great, you know, had tons of stuff on that in his plan. And, you know, he's open sourced his plan and all the other candidates now are rating from it. So I think they're going to get some of that stuff from it too. So I would say that all the candidates are extremely aware that they may be restricted to those measures, and they have a menu of such measures they're willing to take when they take office. But I don't think any of them really want to put that at the center of their messaging.
Right.
You know, this is the season of grand promises that we're in right now.
You write that there are some communities more vulnerable to climate change than others, and some that depend on fossil fuel industries more than others. You write, some communities have been left behind in previous national economic transitions, including the New Deal. We've talked about that on this program multiple times. A lot of jobs that black people had and that women had were basically left out of the Social Security system as part of a compromise with a bunch of bigots and who controlled a lot of power at that time. And so, you know, when we hear about home health care or we hear about home, our home workers, domestic workers, or agricultural workers, they were not involved in the Social Security program. Your question is, what will you ensure that vulnerable communities are protected during the transition to clean energy? Who, from your sense, who were the most sensitive to that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is, I feel like, one area where there's a real clear sense that the party has been effectively pushed to the left by activists. Like on this issue in particular, the evidence is glaring. And this is one of those areas. So this sort of question of, you know, on the one side, how do you deal with communities that are vulnerable to the effects of climate change and the effects of pollution, which tend to be, you know, communities of color and low income communities. And then also, how do you deal with these communities that are going to be disrupted by the transition to clean energy, right? So communities that are tied to the fossil fuel economy, and there are many in the U.S. And so these sort of twin issues are known under the sort of rubric of just transition. And this is used to be kind of an obscure, you know, like fifth item on the list thing that not many national politicians talked about. It was just sort of like the environmental justice community beating the drum. But now it has really moved to the center of the discussion. Like left activists have very effectively pushed this to the center of the discussion, such that every single plan put out by a candidate has to have a big explicit section on this. So all of them are aware of it, and all of them had really good answers. All of them were eager to answer it, right? Because of course this is the question that comes up all the time. Like, are we going to get hurt? Like, are our communities going to get hurt? So they want to put these fears to rest. A couple of candidates have sort of made it their signature in their climate plans. Like Castro has a just transition really high up on his list. Booker has really put this at the forefront. But all of them have just transition elements, and all of them are talking about, you know, worker retraining and ensuring the pensions and healthcare of retired fossil fuel workers. And like Bernie Sanders had a great, I thought it was his best moment at the forum, is someone asked him specifically, like, what about fossil fuel workers? And he got as sort of like as emotional as I've ever they are not my enemies.
Let's play that clip. We have that one right here, actually. Yeah. Here's that clip. This is Bernie Sanders being asked a question by a guy named Grennan Milliken, who is a student at Columbia University.
Thank you very much for that important question. I consider myself to be perhaps the most pro-worker member of the United States Congress. I think I have 100% pro-union AFL-CIO voting record, and I've spent my entire life fighting for workers. So let me be very clear, is that the coal miners in this country, the men and women who work on the oil rigs, they are not my enemy. What is my enemy is climate change. And what we have done is built into our plan, our $16 trillion plan, tens and tens of billions of dollars for what we call a just transition. And that says that if some worker, through no fault of his own or her own, loses their job because we're moving away from fossil fuel, we're going to guarantee them an income for 5 years. We're going to guarantee them the education that they need, because those workers are not our enemies. They should not be punished because we're trying to save the planet.
I mean, that's a pretty comprehensive commitment, at the very least, to that end of the just transition formula, it seems.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because it's always been the right wing, the number one right wing attack on almost any progressive policy, but especially environmental policy, that it's going to it's going to raise your taxes, it's going to take things away from you that you love, and it's going to hurt ordinary working people in the heartland, right? The heartland workers who work with their hands out on the rigs, you know, and drive the Chevy pickup trucks. All this is always the main attack, that it's kind of an elite thing that's going to save critters but hurt ordinary Americans, right? It's the same attack on every environmental policy ever. And we're finally seeing the candidates in the Democratic Party really organize a concerted counter message to that around this just transition, and really attempting to squarely address that. And it's interesting to me who of them, you know, because these media narratives are so deep that, you know, lots of media people just sort of assume them without even knowing they're assuming them. So I'm sort of wondering, like, who among the Democrats might have the the skill or the credibility or whatever it is to sort of cut through that traditional narrative and try to reach those workers and try to make this message of a just transition stick. And it's interesting to think it could be Sanders, right? Because if anybody has credibility about being devoted to, you know, the welfare of workers, it's that guy. So maybe like the media, maybe when he says it, the media will be able to hear it, or at least like convey it in a reasonably fair way. So it's an interesting dynamic that's sort of unfolding right now.
I mean, I was just reading a piece about the Kentucky coal miners who got screwed out of their pay, and they continue, as far as I know, they're continuing to block the last coal train out of there because they want their back pay. But I think it was in that article that they were talking about, you know, while the reporter was there, there was a whole bunch of pizzas that showed up for these guys who were basically camped out there from the Sanders campaign.
Coincidentally. Yeah.
And it is
that's happening in Appalachia around coal mines, and it's now starting to happen in Wyoming too. I wrote an article about this recently. Wyoming mines are now starting to go bankrupt. And it's the same thing. Sort of vulture capitalists come in, pick the company for bones, shed all the pension and healthcare obligations, and then declare bankruptcy, right? And walk away as rich as ever, leaving behind ruin. That's what's happened in Appalachia. That's what's happening in Wyoming. And it is Republican lawmakers who are in charge of these places and who are watching this unfold and letting it happen. It's Mitch McConnell who could step in and stop this stuff, right, at a national level, but he doesn't because he hates the coal miner unions and he likes coal executives. And it's just the whole dynamic about who's looking out for the interests of these workers. You know, they're clearly getting screwed right now under Republicans. And here's like Sanders and Warren and every other candidate over here saying, we'll take care of you. We'll tell you the truth, about the fate of coal and about the transition that's coming, and we'll help you out. So, you know, it'll be really interesting to see if circumstances and that kind of messaging together shift that very, very old and very stale kind of narrative, right, about what environmental policy does.
I mean, that seems to be just a broader sort of, I guess, a political gambit by Sanders is to reach those people
They're all trying. Right. They're all trying, right? Like, it's just like who will the media allow to do it, right? Because if like if Pete, you know, Buttigieg, he's also trying, but like, you know, the media gatekeepers are going to be like, oh, here's this like, you know, elite prep school McKinsey working guy. It's not authentic, you know. So it's who will the gatekeepers allow to say that and sound authentic saying it? That's right. The question.
Let me ask you. Let me just skip ahead from some of the other questions because they get a little bit more specific about the actual policies, and I think largely it feels like the Green New Deal has sort of set, or Inslee, like you say, open sourced his plan and is, you know, people are coming and taking chunks of it. And I think he's very happy about that. I suspect that was basically his agenda from day one. I don't know that he actually thought he was going to be president. The Green New Deal, it seems to me, too, has sort of set a framework for people that is like a constant. It's almost like gravity is almost like the opposite thing I want to express. But it has a magnetic. It has like a magnetic pull on some level that it is sort of like pulling all of their proposals towards a certain direction, a very ambitious direction. And it feels like it's that magnetic pull is working.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really well put. And that's exactly what's happening. And that's exactly what the Sunrise Movement set out to do, right? That's exactly what the activists behind the Green New Deal, it's exactly what they were trying to do. And this is exactly what Inslee was trying to do, right? Is provide that sort of gravitational pull toward greater ambition. And this is like something that the climate movement has been missing for so long, because climate is so complicated, you know, and there's like every sector of the economy, and then there's mitigating emissions, and there's adapting, and there's just so many pieces to it. It's really hard to get a wrap a slogan around it, right? It's really hard to sort of compact it all into something that's memorable and catchy. And the Green New Deal just absolutely caught that lightning in a bottle. Like the Green New Deal, it almost matters less, like specifically what was in the Green New Deal resolution, and more just that finally, like, ambition on climate, doing what's actually necessary rather than whatever we've decided beforehand might be politically possible, right? Really pegging our ambitions to what's necessary. That's what it stands in for. And so you're right. It's just sort of serving as this kind of beacon pulling all the candidates. And like every candidate without exception has come out with a plan that is just wildly ambitious relative to anything you would have seen. And I mean, just like even a year ago, like even the most moderate candidates now are saying, yes, we need to reach complete net zero emissions in the U.S. by 2050, by mid-century, as the IPCC says. And that alone is just like radical. Like if you just follow that back, if you just follow the implications of that target back, it implies radical immediate action. So, you know, like who knows how much the slogan itself did it, or the movement did it, or Inslee did it, or the hurricanes, but like everything's coming together and lifting ambition simultaneously across the board here.
I have one more specific narrow question about the climate stuff, but since we're on this topic, do you think, I mean, because like you and I have had conversations of this ilk for, I don't know, probably a decade maybe now, over that time, back in your grist days. And you are also, you know, one of those guys who's been writing about climate, but has been extremely sensitive to the politics of, you know, the broader politics in which the question of climate has sits. And you've written as much about Republicans as anybody, and sort of the, and Democrats in terms of the way that they address Republicans. I mean, it seems to me that like what's happening with the Green New Deal is not unique to what's happened to politics, you know, from the center to the left.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think one way to describe it is with the Republican Party having become so kind of insular and crazy and drifting off into Alpha Centauri and becoming so plainly impossible to like bargain with or, you know, like it's just not, there's just no point anymore. That has kind of like freed the Democratic Party, at least the sort of vanguard, the primary voters and the leading candidates, to just sort of like let their freak flag fly and start talking more about what they really want to do. So you're getting this weird like disjunct now, like the two parties are just talking about different worlds. My worry, Sam, and this is about climate change, but also about everything, is everything we're hearing from Democrats now, really during Trump and especially during the run-up to the election, is just all people who are trying to appeal to Democratic activists, right? The ones who are paying attention and the ones who are going to vote in the primary. So it's all the kind of ambitious voices and messages we're hearing now. But like, I remember 2008, right? I remember all the hype and excitement going into the Obama administration, and kind of people had just forgotten that there's still a bunch of really crappy, you know, conservative Dems hiding out up there in the Senate. They still exist, right? And we're still going to need their votes. And so, like, I just worry that, like, the rhetoric of ambition has gotten so huge now that there's going to be a real reckoning when all of a sudden we're in a position where Joe Manchin is the gatekeeper to what is allowed to pass. I don't know how that's going to resolve itself, but yes, you're right. I mean, like, the Democratic Party is moving left across the board.
Well, let me bring it back to these candidates then, because that to me, that dynamic, you know, when we if we were to juxtapose that dynamic with, let's say, the healthcare, with the Affordable Care Act, right? The Joe Manchin in that situation could have been, wasn't quite it's not a perfect analogy with like Joe Lieberman, but there's an analogy
it's
there.
It's pretty good.
But there, it's pretty close, right? Because, you know, Joe Lieberman was a guy who used to support a buy-in to Medicare at 55. And then when the insurance companies were pretty clear that if we get the ACA, we're about to save their industry. So they no longer need to offload, those 55 and over folks. Joe Lieberman was against it. And there was a lot of activists at the time who were saying, Obama, go to Connecticut and put some pressure on Joe Lieberman.
Right.
Now, I don't know if that would have worked, but there would have been one way to find out, because I certainly don't know what the cost would have been at this point, looking in retrospect.
I think in retrospect, Obama underestimated how horrible people at Lieberman were.
I think people are more savvy. And the question is there somebody in that field who you think has the ability to go to Joe Manchin, to go to West Virginia, or to go to Arizona, because I imagine we'll have a problem there, too, if we win, right? Or I'm not sure where else it might also be a problem. Go to that state and pressure. I mean, is there a candidate that you see that expressed sort of some awareness and willingness to do something like that?
Right. That's a really good question and really difficult to answer. You know, like it's so tough to imagine what circumstances are going to be and really like what skills are going to be called for. I mean, the first thing I would say, and I say this over and over again, and I said it in 2008, I've been saying it ever since, it's like lots of people sort of, there's lots of undue focus in the American political discussion on the president and sort of a lot of their overestimation of what the president can do. And I think most of the reason that you end up with jerk-offs like Lieberman in a position where they're all of a sudden like their whims are gatekeeping the fate of millions is structural. You know, I mean, you know this, like it has to do with overrepresentation in the of rural areas in the Senate and the Electoral College, on and on and on. But basically, like, you end up in this position where you have to get these marginal, most conservative Dem votes. So there's a lot of sort of structural to it. So I'd say two things. One, like, who can play the inside game? Who's good at building relationships? Who's good at grabbing the levers of power and making things happen? I think Warren. I mean, Warren's my call for that specific skill. I think her history shows it, and I think her, like, one really good example of it lately is, like, the minute Jay Inslee dropped out, she went and met with him, buttered him up, adopted the best parts of his climate plan, probably assured herself a key early endorsement, you know, like, grabbed the credibility that he had on climate change for herself, made a friend of him. Just like, I just thought it was a really savvy move, and I think she's good at that stuff, and I think she's got a proven record of making things happen. So that's one, that's the sort of insider game. But then there's, the outsider game, sort of marshaling an outside activist force to pressure these people, right? And who can do that? You know, like, Sanders is the obvious answer, although I'm very skeptical about whether the sort of movement is going to show up sufficient to do that. But, like, that's the other answer is if anything is going to save us in those situations, if anything's going to pressure Manchin, you know, the sort of modern day Lieberman, I think it'll be less the president him herself than an organized citizen movement. So right. The question of how big and how strong that movement might be is a very much an open question. And it's done a lot on climate so far. Like, it's done a lot more on climate, you know, in the last year than I expected. So who knows? Well, who knows what's possible?
There's a lot of people asking, you know, I think talking about that sort of that Sanders-Warren dichotomy you're talking about, and it's going to really suck when Joe Biden is our nominee. Lastly,
don't even say that, Sam.
Lastly, let me just ask you this question. Here is a question that was put to Elizabeth Warren, and I have a question about that. I mean, like, for me, it is, I have always felt quite strongly that we should be nationalizing our energy production in this country. Like, I'm not convinced that we need to have private energy companies. But here's that question's put to Elizabeth Warren. And I want to get your take on this question, both from the perspective, you know, as to whether it's even a climate question or just simply one of like, or one that has to deal with that question of power. Here is, this is Robert Wood asking a question, a writer and a climate organizer asking a question of Elizabeth Warren.
As president, would you be willing to call out capitalism in this way and advocate for the public ownership of our utilities?
Gosh, you know, I'm not sure that that's what gets you to the solution. I'm perfectly willing to take on giant corporations. I think I've been known to do that once or twice. But for me, I think the way we get there is we just say, sorry, guys, but by 2035, you're done. You're not going to be using any more carbon-based fuels. That gets us to the right place. And if somebody wants to make a profit from building better solar panels and generating better battery storage, I'm not opposed to that. What I'm opposed to is when they do it in a way that hurts everybody else. You shouldn't be able to externalize these costs. That's the problem with fossil fuels right now. I think that the best way we go forward here is we open up the opportunities. We open up the possibilities. We invest in the science. We invest in the manufacturing. We invest in the pieces that let us build a future together going forward. But, you know, I just want to be clear. We got to have tough rules that we are willing to enforce. And that means we have got to be willing to fight back against these giant industries.
So give me your take on that, Dave, because I mean, I'm not convinced. As I watch that question, like, I'm not convinced that she just got worried about the when the guy said, are you willing to take on capitalism that way, as opposed to the sort of the substance of the question. But when she says, you know, the problem is that they're offloading these externalities onto the public. I don't think that there is an energy. I mean, I think you can manufacture solar panels, and I think you can develop better battery technology. But I don't think that there is an energy sort of distribution industry that doesn't on some level offload these externalities for private profit.
Well, this is an enormously complicated question and subject, probably well beyond what we can squeeze in a few minutes of a podcast. But I'll just say that here's the way I'll put it. When we talk about energy companies, we're talking about a lot of different kind of things, right? There's oil and gas companies, which are one thing, regulated one way. Then there are electric utilities, which are responsible for electricity. And that is what Bernie Sanders in his plan has sort of proposed to quasi-nationalize. Although my experience is that even the Sanders fans online don't really understand what he's doing, but he's basically going to nationalize utilities. My understanding, and I have studied power utilities for a long time, and they are extremely complicated, and anything simplistic you want to say about them is going to end up being wrong. So my impression from the experts in the field is that that's not the main axis of the problem, right? But that's not sort of like, that's not where you'd go for a solution. These things are not, I mean, private utility companies are not just like in a free market pursuing the private motive. They are regulated out the wazoo. Like, right. We set up the system that now incentivizes them to want to build more stuff. Like, that's how they make more money. They build more power lines, build more power plants, build. And then they get a sort of guaranteed rate of return on those investments. We can set up the system differently so that they are incentivized to pursue energy efficiency. So they are incentivized to pursue sort of electric vehicle infrastructure. We can set it up so that the profit motive is working to our advantage. And there are, you know, like, I'm not a market absolutist on either end. Like, to me, markets are just tools. There are some places where they work and some places where they don't, some places where you want them and some places where you don't. But in an area where there's tons of innovation and uncertainty, which is very much the electricity industry right now, there's just tons of stuff going on, tons of new tech, tons of new models emerging. It's precisely in an area like that where you want to get the market working for you, where the sort of distributed innovation of a market is perfect. for that kind of area. Obviously, you want guardrails. Obviously, you want everybody taken care of. Obviously, you set baseline standards for, you know, for emissions and everything else. But getting the profit motive working for you, I think, is very important in the electricity industry right now. In this sort of notion of if you nationalize everything, it'll be okay. I just think people need to think about that a lot more before they jump on that bandwagon, especially as some sort of like, you know, sort of lefty, like gatekeeper issue. Like you're not a purist, you know, you're not pure and good unless you jump on this bandwagon. It's just really not that simple. And I just would like ask people, like, you know, there are public utilities out there. Some of them are good and some of them are terrible. Like there's no guarantee. Like, look at the government now. Like, do you want this government completely in charge of the electricity industry from top to bottom? Like, you know, I the notion that public will necessarily yield good results is not necessarily comfortable either. So I would just say on this, I would just urge people, if you're looking for like a litmus test issue, you're looking for like a bottom line issue, this is not the one. There are other policies that are more important, I think. Like for instance, like Bernie wants to ban fracking and some of the other candidates want a slower phase out of fracking. That's a real policy issue. Like that's, I think, something that Sanders fans can reasonably pressure the other candidates about. I would rather them do that than get on this nationalization bandwagon. I just don't think it's a very appropriate vehicle for their sort of ambitions.
And I guess theoretically too, we're talking about, you know, in a post fossil fuel era, those externalities are going to be a lot different, in terms of what they socialize those costs. Like, you know, all the whatever the cancer that we get from the windmills or whatever we're supposed to get from the windmills will be one of those socialized costs.
Well, and you know, if you want the private market to work for you, just say like the U.S. utilities have to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2030. Just put that rule in place, and then all of a sudden, that's the innovation will serve you, right? Then all of a sudden, all their efforts will serve you. Like that's well short of nationalization, but it would be perfectly like effective, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is these questions of to what extent. Yeah, I mean, that answer, I think, makes sense, particularly within the context of climate change in and of itself. And I guess it is also probably a less steep hill to climb to get that level of regulation than nationalization.
Another thing worth pointing out here is that, I mean, there's a sort of element of like ridiculous cosplay to this. You're never going to get the U.S. Congress to pass a law that nationalizes the electricity sector. And honestly, Sam, like the electricity sector, we need working for and finding innovative solutions. That's when markets are good. But you know who we need to just shut down and phase out is oil and gas companies. So like, I don't know why the nationalizers aren't going after them, right? Like if you just want to like take over an industry explicitly to phase it out, like that's
I would start first with the refineries. We nationalize every refinery. We keep hearing about how it's so important to our national security. Good. Let's just we'll take control of that.
Yeah.
Dave Roberts, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Bye bye. I will still take those refineries. That I think we should do that tomorrow, or we'll wait till Monday.
Like, what is the argument for not decommodifying energy in that way?
Freedom.
Well, no, the argument that he was making in terms of not decommodifying is that right now we're in a transition period, and the innovation that you get from having multiple different entities trying to get to certain goals, there's an argument that I think is you know, in terms of innovation.
As long as government cash is behind it in the right way.
Well, I think government cash, they're saying, or he, I didn't think he's saying government cash as much as like make the passageways to where they should head narrow enough so that we get what we want.
I just don't think that's going to happen.
Well, the argument that nationalizing all of it happening is, I mean, look at light bulbs. It's still a controversial issue. Apparently, Trump wants to go backwards on this, but the government did it with light bulbs as an example. The Bush administration raised efficiency standards for light bulbs 10 years ago or something like that. They may have been tightened somewhat during the Obama years. The light bulbs that they first came out with were not great, and now the bulbs are great.
You're a coward.
And there
it
is.
I just say you're a coward.
There's so much at stake here, and I just don't trust the market. I don't trust the private marketplace to get this done in a way that doesn't throw anyone under the bus, especially in marginalized communities.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the point is you need to have strict regulation. The question is which is easier to get to? What's more likely to happen? Very narrowly tailored regulation or a full nationalization?
Well,
of
I mean,
these
light bulbs are also not like the entire fossil fuel industry in terms of the stakes of what type of industry or innovation you need to bring under control.
But as far as the fossil fuel industry, I mean, Warren isn't behind Bernie. She wants to just say you're done. Right, and Bernie wants that too. The difference is on non-fossil fuel energy, right? Isn't that what we're talking
about?
Yeah,
we're talking about non-fossil fuel.
Yeah, in her answer we played on there. She's like, we're just going to tell them that you don't get to do fossil fuels anymore.
I mean,
I don't know. 35.
That timeline is very different, but that might ultimately be true.
But I mean, just for this conversation, we're talking about just energy companies at large, which could include
right.
Like,
I mean, I think everybody's on the same
really
page.
Small,
we
yeah.
end
or solar power plants, and I think the point is like maybe we should just help democratize those workplaces, not necessarily nationalize them. Like, right? There's different options.
Well,
he actually does
for those smaller
exclusive scale
ones. He does have proposals like that. In fact,
yeah, good
right.
Enough.
But I think there is a broad agreement that fossil fuel industry should not exist. And we can talk about the different timelines.
I think even potentially larger. Like, there's a book called Silent Theft about the commons, which comes at it. I don't know if David Bollier would identify as a socialist or not. It's irrelevant. But he was identifying these whole sectors of the economy, whether you're talking about either natural resources, and that could in fact be the sun. He was proposing something called like a sky dividend to pay for transitioning out of the climate crisis. But his broader point was that every type of sort of collectivized natural resource does need to be ultimately held democratically and outside of private hands. And I think that that is just fundamentally true and an important political distinction. Like, it's a very odd notion that, you know, there would be, and the reason the fossil fuel analogy works is just in the notion that, like, why would we ever agree to fossils from the ground being held by private companies? And similarly with wind and solar and other innovations, it's a very odd space to have things that are
wind
so
and
core
solar are different though, right? Because it's
they're
not
common collective resources.
Because
though.
Yeah, and at least the state is
you
hypothetically
don't think so?
Under democratic control, whereas the private industries are not.
Correct. But wind and if we're putting aside fossil fuels, because I think in fossil fuels there's obviously externalities and it's a finite resource, and fossils themselves are finite. But wind and sun are not. And we're talking about ownership of the panels or the windmills.
It should be as like the means of production of energy.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the commons. That's the commons area. I mean, look, it's interesting. Like, there's a new land proposal in the UK, which is getting at the distinction between someone can own a house, but you shouldn't be able to own the land underneath
right,
the house.
Right.
I think that's the type of way you can make it more concrete. But it's an important distinction to carry forward.
I do think in the context of if we get fossil fuels as an industry done, I am less concerned with nationalizing the solar farms, let's say, per se, or the delivery, at least through a certain transition. At one point, it may make more sense.
Those things
are
still going to have a big impact
environmentally,
in terms of how it's delivered.
They're
to
not
people.
Environmentally I mean, neutral. They involve extraction of resources from the third world. And I just don't trust private industry to be responsible about that.
But even somebody like Jeremy Rifkin, who's not again, we're talking like a EU advisor, moderate guy, is basically like, if you don't do what he calls the, I think it's the third industrial revolution in basically a decentralized right way, it will carry forward. Like, you can have, as an example, you know, there's places where there isn't broadband. There can be places that aren't on new electricity grids.
But that's right? What you're talking about is regulation.
Well, or it could be a post office model, which is a national state commons. So that would be something I would be more interested in. But yes, regulation could, I mean, all of these things
we should
could
have
be
without
addressed
a doubt,
by regulation.
Regulation. And I think we do, yes, in terms
or
of electricity.
Yeah.
We have that. I mean, you cannot have an electric company and not serve every place in the country. Now you can do that with cable, apparently. But cable should be regulated in that way,
right,
too, because
even
I don't think it's perceived.
Water's been put in play like that, though. I mean, you've seen municipalities privatizing water. That's incredibly dangerous thing.
Yeah. My concern about regulations is also that it's easier to undo them in a time when industry and private capital acquires more power again.
That's true.
It's harder to denationalize something.
I think that's true as well. It's also... And then the opposite is also true. But yes, I think that's a good point. You know, but it would be a little bit scary. I wouldn't want to trust necessarily the electric grid right now to the Trump administration.
Yeah, do we put it under the Pentagon's like control?
I mean,
like, I think there's decentralized like versions of socialism too, and I think like especially with the current makeup of our state, it might not be a bad idea just to like focus on making
sorry
those
for
workplaces.
The blackouts in blue states that you're subjected to over the summer. That's just tough.
Looks
like
somebody might not have electricity.
Right. Murray Bookchin on municipalism. It's good stuff.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Film Guy will be joining us. Quick break. Quick break. Beep.
Wait, plugs.
Have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas. Perhaps I could have poked or prodded in another way, but I felt trying to figure out why he thinks as he does is what my job is. Have you heard about the SJW nonsense? I don't even care about those guys. It really just honestly doesn't matter. You have to accomplish something in a video game. You have to keep trying to succeed. Yes, can you go to Game Facts or can you get the cheat code and all that stuff? You do, but it really is about you figuring out how to do all this stuff. And that, to me, sort of shows why the media, and especially the leftist media, hates games now, or hates gamers. They don't like people who solve problems. Is this a bridge too far, or am I onto something?
I don't know. I have to think about it. I haven't really thought about it.
I think there's something there. Gamers want to get shit done. Whatever world you're in, whether you're playing a sports game or an adventure game or an RPG or whatever, you're building something. You're accomplishing something. You may have to have teammates and it'll do it. You don't want people to help you do everything and cheat for you. That's not what the left likes.
Sure.
So they have to not like games. I think there's something really there. We'll be right back.
FedEx. That's the way you get them. You get them through the U.S. Postal Service. But you don't get them through UPS.
I'm pretty sure, though, that if the USPS stopped, it didn't exist anywhere, you'd still get chickens delivered. And Amazon could probably do it even more effectively.
We are back. Had a little communication problems. It's been so long since we spoke to our next guest, ladies and gentlemen. It used to be that summer was the time for blockbusters. Well, we've just rewritten the rules, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll tell you why in this little song. Matthew,
yeah.
Film guy, how was your summer?
It was great, Sam. It was busy. I was working. I think I told you I'm editing a feature film, and we spent a month up in Long Lake, New York, editing on set while they were shooting. So it was hectic. It was fast-paced, and it was exhilarating, to be honest with you. It was really fun.
Well, tell us about the film. What can you tell us?
It's called Black Bear. It's directed by my friend, Lawrence Levine. It's starring, Aubrey Plaza, Chris Abbott, and, Sarah Gadon, who your listeners may know from various things. Chris Abbott's from Girls. He was big on, he was in that Catch-22 miniseries. Aubrey Plaza, of course, is the, star of, many films and TV shows.
I recognize none of those names. So far, that's the only awesome, name Sam. Associated
that
with this.
That means it's going to be a hit.
The only names I recognize associated with this are Matthew Weiss, film guy.
Yes.
And
editor.
The first name of the director, Lawrence. I know a Lawrence.
You've never watched Parks and Rec? I feel like you'd be really into it. It's about local government.
No, I know what it's about. I have friends who were on that show quite a bit, but no, I never saw it.
Yeah, that was her breakout. I was actually in my early improv days. I was in a class with her. So she's, has a similar background to you. And this is actually a great kind of a breakout for her. She's playing a dramatic role with some comedy touches. And she's amazing in it. So
she's a Chicago person. Enjoying. There's a lot of Chicago people associated
no,
with that.
No, New York. New York.
Glazer and was on that show. And Amy Poehler, I believe, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Amy Poehler was the star of the show. Yep. Definitely. That is true.
So there you go. I know. Yeah. I'm hip.
Yeah.
I'm hip.
There you go.
I'm with the
sounds
scene.
Great.
I'm with
sounds
the scene.
Very funny.
Yeah. No, all those people were good, but they were all good 20 years ago. So I don't know.
Boom.
They're still good.
They're still good. Well, whatever.
Matthew, can we write some type of Christian apocalypse vehicle where there's like a token Jew played by Sam? Can we do that?
Absolutely. That
would be
great.
I was just thinking something. Oh, no, get to the car. My sciatica hurts. They're going to take our guts.
Now,
you see?
Are you on a speakerphone?
No, I am on my headphones, though. Oh, okay. It's not sounding too good.
It's okay. It's not great. It's not great. We might be able to upgrade that sound. Let's see if you can upgrade it a little bit.
If they take our guns, there'll be a one world government.
Maybe you should have some type of like sound deadening in there. Yeah. Well, this is what.
How's this? Is this any better?
Yeah, that is better. Much better.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is the point. We wanted to ask you about this film. that, of course, Kevin Sorbo is involved with. I am aware of Kevin Sorbo's work. He was Tarzan, I believe.
And no, he was Hercules.
Hercules. Oh, all right. Well, never mind.
Maybe it was Tarzan too, but Hercules is.
He was one of those. I just remember like ads with him with no shirt on. That's what I that seemed to resonate.
You remember the feeling you got when you gazed upon his body.
Exactly. And he is like my old friend Ross Broccoli, now doing religious based film work.
He is.
Ross Broccoli did like a couple of Mormon bankrolled movies, and then I think they figured out who he was, and then they stopped doing.
Oh, okay.
But this is is this a Christian movie?
Like, yeah, I think definitely that there's going to be some Christian elements to it.
He's a but it's a right wing movie, and it's sort of, I guess, like, I don't know. I guess it's the right version of like a Handmaid's Tale in a way.
Or I think people are calling it the Antifa Red Dawn.
Right. Or the Antifa Red Dawn, where the country is taken over by Antifa. And of course, you know, if you carry an American flag in America, then you're in big trouble. Now,
they're attacking the Second Amendment.
Yeah, they're attacking the Second Amendment. And you've never seen more guns in, how long is this thing? This is the trailer.
All those anti-gun anarchists out there.
Right. There's a ton of anti-gun anarchists, but they're taking away the guns. And I don't think I've seen previews of a war movie that have more guns than this one, but here.
National Guard and local responders are overwhelmed in the bigger metropolitan areas.
Maybe we're overreacting.
That was in our neighborhood.
Get everyone in the car.
Pause it. Hold it. So we should just tell you that, you know, it's a family in a suburban area. And the wife is basically just saying to Kevin Sorbo, like,
super white.
Maybe we're overreacting. And then deus ex machina, the gunshots in the suburbs. We're in trouble. Let's get mobilized.
They're coming for our lake house.
That was in our neighborhood.
Get everyone in the car.
Cash my office now.
It's the liberal.
Old town's on fire. The police are retreating. We have prepared for this. We will survive.
Go. The world is falling apart.
The Second Amendment is under attack. Guys are driving motorcycles through windows.
The family dream, 3 meals a day, it's over.
Hey!
You ain't going anywhere.
It's adapt or die.
What would you do?
Phones are on timeout is what I would do.
You guys go. Go. Stay alone.
If your family was attacked.
Get in the car, Myla.
The guy's got a sword? When guns are outlawed.
Guns are banned from my sobriety.
Only outlaws will have guns.
You guys aren't invited to the Social Security meeting room.
The Reliant. Protect family and faith.
I read Handyman magazine. Get away. I'm an everyman.
Wait, am I part of the the rebellion or the what part of what?
Oh no,
you're an innocent victim.
You're an innocent victim.
I'm just a victim in this.
You're just a victim.
I just am one of the guys.
I promote Antifa, my podcast. No.
At the beginning, you're assuring them that there's actually nothing to worry about.
Yeah,
and then you're get killed by Antifa.
You're the first. Exactly. You're like, everybody needs to calm down because you're all listening to this right wing garbage. And I was talking with Janine about this 15 years ago, and then all of a sudden, Antifa guy clubs you.
This is from IMDb.
And then a good Christian family has to save your kid.
IMDb, that's right. It raised them as a Christian.
Raised them as Christian.
I hope you guys realize this movie is basically porn for me.
Matthew, let's write this like immediately as soon as you get back.
Just be careful when Michael says let's write this.
Matthew. Pre-prepared.
Put my name first on the script.
Accept.
But wait, here's from IMDb.
Alphabetical order.
A 19-year-old woman cares for her sibling after an econometric collapse leads to widespread violence. And then, and this is
econometric.
Yeah, and then,
there's no such thing as an econometric collapse. I was talking with somebody at the Center for American. Ow!
IMDb says the economic collapse causes widespread rioting and social unrest, leaving a lovesick 19-year-old girl struggling to care for her siblings in a stretch of woods bordered by lawless anarchy.
Oh God, it sounds
wondering
so good.
Why a good God.
So it's outside Portland. Like, what is this?
Why a good God would let this happen?
When is this movie out, and where can I see it?
I'm
shocked at the production values, really. I mean, it is, there is not a little.
Filmed in Ohio.
Yeah, these people have money behind them, always.
Filmed in Ohio, buddy.
I mean, it's like, hey, listen, this is an independent film. So it's like the dark side of the kind of democratization of the Hollywood studio system. Like, you got a bad idea and enough money behind it, you can make a movie with Kevin Sorbo that looks like, you know, $1 million.
If you happen to be, and I don't know where this is, actually, but on August 3rd, it premiered August 3rd at the Great Lakes Christian Film Festival. Do you go to that film festival on your film festival tour?
No, that is, I've stopped putting that on my circuit.
Oh, that's in Buffalo, New York. So, I mean, it's almost local. No,
it burns my skin when I walk into that festival, so I can't go.
I got no problem with the Christian Film Festival circuit, as Who's the Caboose basically stumbled into the Jewish Film Festival circuit played all around the country. It was fantastic, actually.
Thank you very much.
I was just talking with Digby about this on my show the other day. It's nothing to worry about.
Ow!
That was on Ring of Fire, which you could download. Actually, that's also on the Majority Report app. Ow!
Yeah.
There you go.
He's like the mayor in Ghostbusters. He's like, shut it down.
Mayor. He's also the mayor in Red Dawn.
That's
except
true.
The mayor in Red Dawn lasts for a couple of cycles. He becomes the willing collaborator.
There's apparently some very other good movies at that festival.
So maybe Sam would be like the mayor with
at the Great Lakes Christian Film Festival. Here's the 2019 schedule in the Kennedy Room and the McKinley Room. Wait a second. Okay. Oh, all right. There's a lot of praise and worship that goes on. That did not happen at the Jewish Film Festival.
Oh, we missed it.
There's the Miracles from the Killing Fields, 10 a.m. Saved, Escape from Kim's Regime, Dinosaur Heart, Finding a Home in Boomtown, The People of the Heavenly Kingdom, Liberating Fire, Broken Unbroken, Betty Williams, Contagious Courage, Warriors to Lords. It's amazing, like, so much
Warriors
of this is,
the
like,
Lord.
These are all sort of a like...
Love, possibly?
There is... but the point is, like, there's only a couple of things that the rest of them are
life
sort of, like...
Life on the Island of Jesus.
Yep.
Oh, my
Welcome
God.
Welcome to Jesus Island. Only one person will be saved.
to tie the knot
only
or
one
not.
Gets to ascend. Yeah.
I think I know what the moral of that story is.
A lot of you guys want to live in eternity with me, and I wish I could take all of you, but it's only going to be one. Jesus
Island. I cannot believe that I missed this, but I will be going next year with the help of some plants and chemicals.
I am so stoked to have you all on Jesus Island. Unfortunately, only one of you can stay.
Who's going to meet St. Peter?
Who's going to meet St. Peter?
Like, what the hell, man? Why did no one tell us about this?
Tom, it's been really awesome having you on the island. You have good energy and are a good person, but unfortunately,
panel.
You're going to hell.
Sam, let's go to the industry panel.
That would be actually pretty fun to go. But you know what? There is a huge... The fact of the matter is, there is a huge Christian film industry. And also, you know, not just film, but also radio. And there's a whole... You know, sort of like another parallel media. And on some level, that's like, you know, Fox and conservative media has followed this sort of same business model, which is like you can have a thriving industry that exists. And it's just simply creates another narrative. The difference is, of course, when people watch Fox, they don't realize that they're involved in, you know, sort of some type of alt media. as much as
overtly alternative, right?
But so
the righteous gemstones, the very funny, by the way.
Distribution systems.
Yeah, it is the downside of it, in that some people become, you know, can get squirreled off. The problem is, it's not even so much the problem with the fragmentation as much as the when one of these fragments gets too big. Like, I think if, you know, everything was small, it would be better.
How big is it, though, really? I mean, compared to, like, you know, mainstream Hollywood movies, is it even as big as what plays at, like, Sundance or?
I was talking about in terms of, like, the news. But I would be very surprised if this industry was not a huge, huge industry.
I don't know. They all, you know, they all listen to Striper and Creed and watch these Jesus Island movies, I guess. It's a niche. Just like if you're a horror fan, you go to the horror convention or the, you know, specific genre. It's a genre. It's just a genre with a detrimental political message.
I don't think it's a genre. I think it's an industry. I think it's an industry of and to itself. You know, horror is a genre within the film industry, but the mechanics of the industry are the same. And the, you know, this, I think, is its own thing apart. I mean, that was my sort of understanding, you know, in the radio business, you could see that as well, that there was like, there were different rules as to who the audience was and their behavior was going to be different. And therefore the way that they finance these things are going to be different. And the way that they recoup and make money off it is going to be different.
You're saying the people behind these, they're just making Christian movies. They're not next week making a romance movie or a kids in jail movie. They're only Christian. Yeah.
Exactly. Fade in. A middle-aged Jewish man, Sam Cedar. When the right has power, they focus on cultural
format is a Jewish conspiracy, so I wouldn't use fade in.
Let me just word of advice. Just make sure Michael delivers the writing first before you deliver yours.
I dictate my writing.
He's the ideas man.
Right. Exactly. We were doing it right now. Are you taking notes?
I've already got the first draft.
Fade in. When the right wing controls political power, they focus on cultural issues.
A nebbishy Jewish man repeats
the same point.
Can we play Life on the Island of Jesus trailer?
Oh, please.
He just put it in the chat.
That one caught my eye. So
that one, I thought we had a good read on.
And I want to make this clear. We're not making fun of Christians. We're making fun of Christian movies.
No. That's right. And Kevin Sorbo, which, by the way, that trailer showed the same shot of Kevin Sorbo, like, looking up into the sky, like, four times. Did they not get that much time with him?
It gets better every time.
They had to keep, like, taking the same shot and then flipping it slightly and then cropping it differently?
No, it didn't even flip it. It was just, like, that same, like, dolly into his face looking up in fear of liberals, like, over, like, four times, I think.
Anarcho-liberals.
They call that take hearing gunshots in suburbia.
These are the same people.
I wonder if he was really in the whole movie.
Here it is. Official nominee. Oh, this is a documentary? Let's just play it.
Jesus Island? It's even more scary.
On the island of Jesus. Life.
In a small group I'm a part of, we were discussing the idea of handing God a blank check. At a similar age, my parents made that decision to abandon everything and come to Quebec.
Oh man, this is gonna be
okay. I don't think this not.
Let
this
me just.
Not,
can I make a prediction that I hate to make?
What else do you got?
In 10 years, the documentary that is made about the process that led to this documentary is going to be terrifying.
Dinosaur Heart or Saved, Escape from Kim's Regime.
I think they're all
documentaries. All right.
These are the same people who will tag like Nancy Pelosi, AOC. And me and like my show and all the fake Antifa Twitter accounts in one tweet because they think that we are somehow connected. Like Antifa is the paramilitary wing of the Democratic Party.
You are connected.
Trying to take all our guns. Okay. All your Second Amendment attacks.
Time for the mask off.
The police are retreating because they only have tanks.
Wink, wink.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that a movie like that, it validates all of their sort of paranoid delusions, not just about Antifa, but the idea that, like, look, we need to have these guns. It may be Antifa. It'll probably just be, you know, black people.
Hungry people.
Or it could be the cops. Who knows who's going to come after us? But the point is we need to have these guns so that I can save my family in the suburbs. And if we have to go out into the woods, at the very least, at least I have that survival handbook. And we're going to figure out, we're going to pick berries and shoot squirrels and, make.
Well, there's that moment, grab all the matches. There's that moment in the trailer where he's like, we've prepared for this. Like, this is what we've been waiting for.
That's actually the most amazing moment in Red Dawn, which is my favorite. Like, that's an actual.
Are you talking the original?
The original. I haven't seen the new one.
Well, that's Sam's favorite movie, too.
That's a legit hysterical, like, irony watch. And the scene where they go. And I love, like, all of these incredible scenes because, like, the Soviets totally occupy this town with, like, Cuban paramilitaries, but they can also literally walk up to the chain link fence where, like, their dad and everybody else is being detained for, like, a chat and not be noticed. And basically their dad pretty much tells them, like, well, now you understand why I had to kick the shit out of you every day, because we're planning for a Soviet invasion. I had to be like an abusive dad because the Soviets were going to come.
I knew this was going to happen. Yeah, this is what I've been training you. Remember all the times that I wouldn't talk to you or I was hard on you? This is why.
No, he literally was like, that's why I gave you the belt, because I knew this day was coming.
Or
that the Soviets were going to invade Idaho. That's why your father wouldn't speak to you.
That is really disgusting to me to think these Christian films are encouraging people to believe their worst impressions about human nature and to be even more fearful and sort of, banding together in violence. It's like the opposite of what a film guy should be looking for in a film.
Well, I would respect the hell out of this movie if it turns out to be like The Babadook, where like halfway through you realize that the protagonists with the guns are actually the terrifying monsters.
Matt, play this. Matthew Film Guy, you remember this because you worked, you may have even edited this back in the day. But when Marin and I did Break Room Live, we had We came up with this sort of, you know, we developed a bunch of like, freestanding bits that we could just plug into on any given day. And so I had this idea that in RNC headquarters, the way that they would get their talking points was be to go into the study and one of a Red Dawn poster would talk to them. And this is, I don't even know what this one was about, but we did a bunch of these.
I remember this. This is Bill.
Listen up, freedom fighters. Tonight, Barack Hussein Obama is going on ABC, otherwise known as the American Barack Obama Corporation, to explain his healthcare proposal.
It's an infomercial.
What a coincidence. Healthcare starts with an H, and so doesn't Barack Hussein Obama.
It's an Al-Qaeda infomercial.
This is unprecedented.
Yeah. Precedented.
No, unprecedented.
Right.
News organizations should not be allowed to let presidents explain policy.
Yeah, I want to watch Wife Swap.
Journalism is dead.
Yeah, I want to see Extreme Makeover House Edition.
ABC needs to give insurance companies equal time.
According to the Constitution Amendment thingy.
Only 76% of Americans want a public health insurance option. Who will speak for the remaining 74% of the American people who don't?
It's an infomercial.
Obama is abusing the bully pulpit. Healthcare isn't bullying.
It's more like a pansy pulpit.
He should be attacking Iran
and take their health care.
Now go and spread this information. It's an infomercial.
Yeah, infomercial.
And this was at the time they must have been saying that this was an infomercial that ABC was allowing the president to speak on national television.
Total infomercial. Total infomercial.
And I don't need to remind people, but I will, that I did a movie with one of the guys in Red Dawn. And I can't remember his name.
What was it?
C. Thomas Howell.
Oh, yeah, we got blown through the window.
Oh, the one where you got blown through the window.
Yep.
That was funny.
Yep. So there you go.
That was.
I got a gift of that somewhere. Where's my gift?
Now, so like, Matthew Film Guy, let's get to business here. Let's stop dilly dallying. We've been doing this for 20 minutes now already.
That's nice.
What do you got for us?
All right. So, in getting ready for this movie that I'm making with Larry Levine, he had me watch a couple directors, and one of the ones that really stuck with me and has basically become one of my favorite international directors at this point is a South Korean filmmaker named Hong Sang-soo. Now, he is, in all honesty, a true and rare artist. He's a minimalist. His films, and he's made 23 of them since the 90s. Wow. And I've only seen four so far, but I fell in love. His movies are, they play with time and repetition. So in this movie that we're making, it's kind of like there's two halves. I don't want to give too many spoilers about it, but Hong Sang-soo's movies often have the same plot elements replaying in a second kind of set, like it resets. And it's all about social mores and the vagaries of romantic and platonic desires. You know, a little bit like Eric Rohmer, if you know the French filmmaker Eric Rohmer, not to be a pederast, but he's one of the best French filmmakers.
I'm glad you listened
Anyway, Sue, he doesn't use conventional story structure or doesn't have the kind of resolutions that you're kind of looking for. He's a master at playing with your perceptions, you know, replaying the segments that you've seen from other points of view. It's just he forces you in the best way to reassess your feelings about what you've seen before and draw your own conclusions. One of the main movies I want to recommend is Right Now, Wrong Then. I showed that to my class recently and it went over big. That actually has the same sort of
now that's from 2015, if I'm not mistaken, right? That's
how did you know that? Oh my God, you're so good.
It's one of the more recent of his films. Yeah.
Yeah. Another one that's great is Tale of Cinema. Often it has the
that's from the mid-aughts, if I'm not mistaken. The mid-aughts.
Yeah, good again. Right. You nailed it again. Wow, that's pretty good.
Thank you.
Do you know when the movie he made called The Day He Arrives was made?
2011?
Yes! This is getting good. Oh. Anyway, The Day He Arrives, Right Now, Wrong Then, Tale of Cinema, and another one called In Another Country, which actually has French actress Isabelle Huppert in it. Those four,
he did
I
that right after.
Down.
Right after The Day He Arrives. That was like sort of like Irish Twins, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know what? What's interesting about Hong Sang-soo, from what I've read...
Total pederast over here.
Yeah, Sam, easy on the pederasty, please, for
sure.
All our sakes.
Sure.
But from what I've read about Hong Sang-soo, he started making movies now with no screenplay or treatment. He starts the process just like with the actors, a location, and a rough idea, and then he writes the script every day in the morning before the shoot. Maybe, Michael, maybe you and I could do that about the Sam movie.
Yeah, that's
know.
What I was thinking. But, something more kind of informal.
Inspirational and improvisational.
He's got to riff it.
Yeah. But
I mean, I certainly have all of Sam's.
What does he shoot on?
Ready.
What are people shooting on? When you go up to do this film up in Buffalo, what are they shooting on?
It's Long Lake. But yeah, it's digital video. It's a huge digital airy camera. You know, it's like 4K video. Actually, we shot like 2.5K. But it's digital, baby. But it's using, you know, cinema lenses and
right.
the full kit. So that's what we use these days.
Interesting. And so that greatly diminishes the lighting requirements. Yes or no?
No. It doesn't change that at all. Actually, what it does is allow us to shoot for days and days and days and give the editor tons more footage to have to comb through because you can just keep shooting because it's very
right.
inexpensive to have.
And you don't
media.
Have to you don't
like,
have to spend
like
20 minutes switching the mag and checking the gate and all that stuff is done.
That's right, Sam. Those days are over. Uh-huh. I've got like 18 terabytes of media here representing this movie. So
right. That's why they're bringing editors on. That's why editing is starting early because you got to log all this stuff. Right. And
that is exactly right, Sam. I mean, actually editing on set, one of the benefits was that I could put together sort of drafts of some scenes and see if we needed to reshoot anything,
right.
see if anything wasn't working, take it a different way. So I was able to sort of feed back to the production while they were still on set with the actors and everybody present. It was sort of a one location thing. It was like in a cabin in the woods. So yeah. But anyway, back to Hong Sang-soo, who I want to definitely give the hugest credit for basically introducing me to the Korean drink of soju. Do you guys know what this is? It's like
no.
the Korean rice wine.
Yeah, it's what they used to make Bloody Marys with in bars that don't have their liquor license.
Oh, nice, nice. Because it is consumed like in every movie. He's got like some repetitive themes, and one of them is that people getting drunk off their faces on soju and stumbling around. And it's actually, I haven't really mentioned it, but these movies are hilarious too. They have a lot of very funny, awkward moments, some deep and sort of moving stuff too, but people are always drunk and smoking a lot of cigarettes. And I get the sense that this is autobiographical for him because a lot of the characters are either filmmakers or actors, excuse me. But anyway, the fact that he makes up the script on the day and then you see what he actually comes up with is mind-blowing, because the films are tightly structured and they have a very precise aesthetic, even though it's in that minimalist style. But honestly, I'm about to go on another binge and see the next, whatever, 20 of his movies.
So where should we start? Right now, wrong then? Is that the place to start?
I got to say, I would say start with In Another Country. Because that is a home run. It has an actress that you may have seen in some other international cinema. It's really one of the more funny ones. Right Now, Wrong Then is also you can't go wrong with any of those. If you're a real film pederast, you can start with Tale of Cinema. That would be the one for the people who are really into film. That's got more of that kind of playing with the form. But all of those are excellent.
Fantastic. All right. I always say I'm going to watch it, but I put on my list. And folks, not only do we put Matthew Film Guy's recommendations on our page, but we also link to his letterbox.
The ministers always say there'll be an economic collapse, but that's not what Dean Baker says, you idiots.
Ow!
Ow! My glasses!
My glasses fell. Oh, no. Antifa's here. The econometric collapse.
That's going to be a huge hit. That's going to be a huge hit. Also, I want to say I'm shooting my friend Ted Alexandra, who I still do his podcast, A Little Bit Me. If people want to check out a great comedian podcast, A Little Bit Me with Ted Alexandra, he's going to be on Laughing Liberally tonight, which is a show on Broadway. I think Janine's going to do it one night, where it's a bunch of libtards doing stand-up comedy about politics.
Right.
Should be great.
Fantastic.
You produce that pod?
Yep.
Oh, cool.
I produced and edited it. Yes. It's been a lot of fun. And check it out, A Little Bit Me.
Are you on mic, too?
No. No, I am not. This is basically A Little Bit Ted. It's like he takes the rig with him when he goes on the road. He opens for Jim Gaffigan wherever he's playing. He kind of gives his thoughts. There's certain segments. He does a great segment where he cold calls comedian friends that aren't suspecting the call until they get it, and then they approve it or don't approve it. Called The Catch Up. That's been a fun bit.
Oh, that's
so,
good.
What
are you up to? Well, that's sort of what this is about, this segment. But it's okay. Ted can
start. I mostly answer the phone when you call.
Matthew Film Guy, as always, a pleasure. I will check out Hong Sang-soo, and even if I don't, someone will. And so
I hope
thank
someone
you.
Will.
All right, buddy. I'll talk
My
to you.
My pleasure,
soon.
Sam. Anytime. Take
okay.
care.
Bye. Oh, also, don't forget, we didn't even check in on his eBay thing. I have a feeling his eBay thing has probably suffered because of his work.
He's actually doing something.
Folks, we're going to do a Freebie Friday today. We only got about a half an hour left, and we're just going to let you ride all the way through. But don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Folks, check out that Just Coffee. And also, listen to the AM Quickie. We're a week or two away from splitting it off from the Majority Report feed. So you will be getting that every morning. And we're getting it out the door a little bit earlier now, right? A little bit, more or less. So check that out. Also, today is Friday, which means that Tuesday was Tuesday. What happened on Tuesday, Michael?
Crystal Ball and I discussed why the establishment is lining up behind Elizabeth Warren, what that means for the fate of the race and how to understand the race. Then Artesia Balthrop, who is a friend of mine and is a TV producer, talked about the Jay-Z NFL deal and Jay-Z's remix of the Moynihan Report. Also Kashmir and the history of a paramilitary group called the RSS. This coming Tuesday, Kianga Amada Taylor and Bhaskar Sunkara are going to be on, as well as Napoleon the Legend. Today, publicly available, there's a link on Majority.fm. Get your tickets to the next TMBS live show, November 23rd, the week before Thanksgiving in Philadelphia, with special guests Crystal Ball, Emma Viglin, and Artesia Balthrop. Looking forward to seeing you guys.
Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
So this week on the Antifada, I was not around, but the guys did a very special crossover episode of the Antifada, Prolet Cult, History as a Weapon, and J.G. Michael's Parallax Views about Operation Gladio. So in this special crossover episode, they take a dive into the stay-behind operations after World War II, which were designed to protect Western Europe from leftist victory at any cost, including coups, assassinations, and false flag terror plots. Is this conspiracy theory? No, it's parapolitics, which dwells in the realm between the political and the confirmed and the conspiratorial. So check it out. Also, if you want even more conspiracy, parapolitics, there's a bonus out today with more of that good stuff. Also, I would like to plug an article that I wrote in Commune magazine. It's sort of a meditation on the DSA convention, but other topics related to that that came up at the convention. It's called When the Wave Crashes, and you can read it at communemag.com. It's on the front page right now, so check it out.
I tried reading it in a book about Gladio, and it was pretty interesting in the Europe parts, and then the modern stuff was all about Gulen, which was very confusing.
The Gulen movement.
Yeah, it was really? it was lunacy. It was like it got it really Islamophobic too. But
Gulen, as in like Gulen Turkey.
Yeah, the Turkish guy.
That's interesting.
It's very bizarre.
I would actually still read that because I want to know how he's even making those.
Yeah, it was a while ago, but I was like, what am I doing here? Yeah, for a literary hangover recorded last night, the second part of James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, which is a story about, basically a fictionalized story about how his dad settled central New York, and a lot of stuff there. So, yeah, check it out.
All right, folks, we're not going anywhere. Sorry, we were doing a Freebie Friday.
All right.
There you go.
We continue. Let's
just get to this. I don't know how, I don't even know if we're not going to have time for calls, folks. I'm going to just do IMs. I don't want people holding as much as I know that people like to write
sort of a bit
cartoons
at this point
with me
sort of a bit
not answering the phone for people,
but people do like that rapid fire segment we've been doing.
The third, yeah, I do too. We used to do that on radio. I used to do like the at the end of the show, I would do the 30 seconds and that's it, but I don't know. Maybe we can do that. We'll see. See how we go here. But we've got some bad news, ladies and gentlemen. And in some ways, we have not dared to push the stretch of our imagination. Yes. America is clearly not the place that we all want it to be. Or maybe it is, actually. We all remember this moment when Bill Burton, who probably got about $2 to $5 million to basically say this on television and then spend the rest of his time also just like telling Howard Schultz that he was really gonna, this was gonna kick ass. This happened in January. Can you believe it? 9 months ago.
On social media, there's a certain op-ed you wrote in 2016 for the Sacramento Bee that's been making the rounds. Let me put up a piece of it. If Stein or Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson eat into Clinton's support even a little, that could matter in a close election. And in the same way, I would bet that Ralph Nader, or at least many of his supporters, wishes that he didn't help to make George W. Bush our 43rd commander-in-chief. I suppose Stein supporters would not want to be in the position of explaining to their kids how they helped make Trump president. Why should you not eat those words today?
Couple of things. Number one, Howard Schultz is not Jill Stein. Jill Stein was in that race because she thought that the two parties were too close together. The two candidates.
Pause
were too
it for
close
one
together.
Second. He starts at number one, but really he's starting at number two, because number one is, well, Todd, I'm making a lot of money. I'm making so much money, Chuck, that like you're going to work this year and next year and probably like multiple years before you get to make what I'm making for what I imagine is going to be maybe 16 months.
What Howard Schultz thinks is that the polar opposites of the parties are so far apart, but the American people are close together. And maybe what we need is a choice for the American people to choose something different, a different path, a different kind of politics in America. And secondly, I just think that he, first of all, hasn't made the decision to run. But if he did, I think we can agree that it would be a more serious effort than what Jill Stein put together.
Well, fair enough. And we still don't know how much help Jill Stein had from outside actors, given where she spent December of 2015. But let me ask you this. He obviously, you're using this book tour to launch an exploratory bid, as well as any book tour launch for a presidential bid, as I've seen in a while. So it's clear you want this to be the front. Why? What I'm trying to figure out is I don't understand why he wants to run other than he's not them and not them. What is the big idea beyond not a Republican and not a Democrat?
Well, the book tour, he wrote the book. Whether he was going to think about this or not, because he has a story to tell and he wanted to get it out there. You know, he's a guy who grew up in the projects and was self-made. He worked his way through college. He went on to build a great company that did the right thing by the folks who worked for it. And now he wants to continue to serve. In terms of what his big idea is, it's that politics is broken. And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
You know, I forgot that he was off camera because there's no doubt in my mind he is reading it. Like, go back, just go back like 20 seconds. You know that he's reading it because he can't even like, there's you can't, he's just like literally going like, that risks the possibility of a new, and he's doing that, and that's probably why they've got this B-roll over him. Go ahead.
On to build a great company that did the right thing by the folks who worked for it, and now he wants to continue to serve. In terms
continue
of what his
serve.
Big idea is, it's that politics is broken.
You can hear papers rustling.
Well, I don't know if they could be Chucks. But I also forgot this part about like where he says he started a new company, wants to continue to serve.
Yeah, being a CEO is really being called to service.
He was involved in public service.
Can I just say, I mean, whatever, always F Jill Stein, but seriously, dude? Chuck Todd has to go with the deranged Russia stuff with her.
Yeah, I think it's probably more likely they got the money from the Republicans, but like they did it in Pennsylvania. But wait, just finish it.
Politics is broken, and maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
He asked for B-roll because he was laughing while he did it. He's right. Like, guys, Howard insists that I read this. Yes. And what I'm asking you as a friend is if the camera not be on me while I read.
It's like, look.
I don't want there to be evidence.
How much? I'll give you 10 grand right now. Yeah. 10 grand's falling out of his pocket. He hands him 10 grand. He'll put a little B-roll over
this. I'll throw you 10 grand. You could have a couple of shots.
So Howard
Schultz has a Starbucks board meeting.
Howard Schultz is dropping out of the race because apparently after his maybe has some illness that's going on, which I... Yeah, maybe it's possible.
Too much money.
He's got affluenza.
He has deep affluenza.
He has deep affluenza, and
that's one armchair diagnosis I'm comfortable with.
Even this Washington Post, his letter announcing his decision not to run was tinged with an irony. Schultz maintained that the window for a moderate, reasoned third-party candidate was wide open, but he could not figure out how to grab and hold voters' attention in an electoral cycle dominated by angry partisan voices. In other words, there's a huge market for what I'm doing out there, but somehow my millions of dollars in access to 60 Minutes and every cable news station and every newspaper in the country, I couldn't find those people.
I had unlimited press coverage for a campaign that had absolutely zero public interest, and I was able to hire two of the top pundit political consultants in the country. But somehow
there was no outlet I could not get on.
And it was weird because there's a market that's just hungry for this.
I was in the Times. I was on the like cover of news of like magazines, and I couldn't get a single. And he supposedly sent this to all his supporters. And honestly, like, do you think that they spent anything on posting? I mean, like they didn't even need to get one of those email programs that emails everybody, because there was so few they could just do it out of Gmail.
Tom Steyer is like the Marty Funkhauser candidate. It's like, you don't get it. You got to get a whole bunch of emails for a fake cause,
right?
And then you run for president, you moron.
Risked too much imagination.
Supposedly, he's going to do something that is good for, you know, like he's like, there was some, I can't even remember what it was. Like he's gonna go, well, he's gonna promote democracy or something.
Okay, good. Go
give away your money. Honestly, pour your money into Senate races, okay, and into state house races. There's two or three states you could make a big difference if you really care about something.
I should have mentioned this before. Christian Piccolini is on Twitter basically asking to crowdsource a significant amount of money so he can keep doing the work he does, exiting people from hate organizations. Why don't you write him $1 million?
No kidding. So there it is. Howard Schultz, we don't have him to kick around anymore. Now, folks, this is important. This is important stuff. As you know, Dave Rubin has joined the conservative online conservative network that launched such people as Gavin McGinnis, that promotes the homophobia of Stephen Crowder. Here is Dave Rubin returning to the grid after 33 days.
I haven't been paying attention to anything at all.
No.
He does not look relaxed.
And he is talking about this new technology that he's developed that is basically Patreon, but just for himself, and how he is going to open up. And now, folks, the gist here is for Dave Rubin is that, that he's going to keep the trolls out, and we're going to address that. But here's Dave Rubin.
People left Patreon, all that. So the big debate, which philosophically, which we've hit on here a couple times, for me has been, do you get the government involved or not? So without rehashing that whole conversation, and you know my preference is that I would not want that.
Right.
I did what I thought was the right thing, which is I started a tech company about 6 months ago, and I went to literally one investor. I got investment. I started it with a really great startup guy that I know. And we are building a seriously awesome, what will first be a Rubin Report app. So we're building it because what I thought was, I can't solve everyone's problems first. Mm-hmm. I want to solve my problem first. I want to make sure I can always communicate with my audience. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure my audience can communicate with me. I want
Pause
to make sure
it.
My
so,
videos.
So what he needs is some form of like a communication that goes back and forth. But IM's not going to cut it. Neither phones. There's got to be something like a forum. A forum. We're going to develop something like a forum, but it's going to be better than that. It's going to be like a private forum, like almost like a, it's going to be discordant in some way. It's going to be like a Discord.
This is literally, listening to him talk is like a conversation about like the founding of like the Well community in the 1980s, if it was done by an incredibly stupid person.
It's
like technology like being envisioned that doesn't exist yet by an idiot.
I think it's because his Reddit looks something like this with things like this at the top.
Wait. Keep that. Don't step on this. Let's start with this. So here he is. This is like, imagine, this is like what you're about to hear now. And it's, he describes his new technology that he's developed. It's literally like me showing up one day and going, folks, I've got a new idea. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get a backdrop behind me and I'm going to get a microphone and I'm going to opine about various different things. And I'm going to do it every day at the same time. We're going to stream it live through video. And that's what we've developed. But here he goes.
Can't solve everyone's problems first. Mm-hmm. I want to solve my problem first. I want to make sure I can always communicate with my audience. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure my audience can communicate with me. I want to make sure my videos can be posted. And if people mm-hmm. actually subscribe, they can see them and not mm-hmm. be manipulated.
Like
I want to figure out ways to have real community building where audience members can communicate with each other without
Discord
fear of censorship
again.
Or being destroyed.
Correct.
I want to figure out how to monetize that properly so that subscribers, because you know, if you have a subscription service, you've eliminated 99%
pause
of the
for
trolls
one second. Wait
because
second.
You can say...
Now, he said, I want to learn how to monetize that properly. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I mean, the membership model is pretty well set. I mean, is he talking about he wants smaller processing fees? Or, but we find out what it... Monetizing it properly means figure a price point that will make it hard for people who want to troll me. But... Because look at, let's go to his Reddit thing. This is the problem. This is really the problem that Dave Rubin has. In his own Reddit, it's not, he doesn't own it, but it was one that was supposedly built to promote him. People are mocking him constantly, which is really rude. Things like, LOL, how can a grown adult working in media current events go off the grid? You can truly tell how much Dave Rubin cares about what's going on in the world, that he goes off the grid and doesn't watch the news once. What an effing moron. Steven Crowder still thinks Hitler was a liberal socialist. Rubin panders to his boomer MAGA audience with the lame plastic straw joke. Let's see what else he's got. Definitely not staged. Yes, I was truly off the grid with no phone or news for 33 days. Right. Okay. I mean, this is his fans. But let's go back.
Hold on.
Let this run a little bit.
Scribe, they can see them and not be mm-hmm. manipulated. I want to figure out ways to have real community building where audience members can communicate with each other without fear of censorship or being destroyed.
Correct.
I want to figure out how to monetize that properly so that subscribers, because, you know, if you have a subscription service, you've eliminated 99% of the trolls because you can say a lot of things about the trolls, but the trolls are cheap.
So.
And the trolls are not, nobody's going to pay me to troll me. But if you subscribe to me,
they will.
But, well, if you do, guess what? I'm not creating a platform for everyone where I'm going to be hurting your free speech. I just won't take your money. And bye-bye, you're gone. So I think...
Okay, pause it. Now, wait a second. Didn't he just say 15, 20 seconds earlier that we're going to have a way of communicating without any censorship or anything like that? I mean, didn't he just say that? And so now he's saying that, well, I'm going to weed out the trolls. Now, look, folks, I'm not going to promise anything right now because I want to see what these price points are. But I think it's very possible that what we're going to do, because, look, I feel somewhat responsible because I think, you know, we here at this show and you've used this platform in some way to at the very least force Dave to come clean with the fact that he's actually, you know, a conservative, or at the very least his show. I don't know what he is in his personal life. I don't know if he has any.
I'm married to a man.
Yeah. No, without getting into identity politics.
I'm gay married.
Without getting into identity politics, he definitely shares some libertarian philosophies. But his show is geared towards presenting primarily conservative views. I mean, that's why he's on the Blaze. And if that in any way inhibited his financial growth, I feel horrible about it. And so what we are probably going to do, and we need to wait until the app is rolled out, is I think every week, we're, maybe we'll do a little contest or something where someone wins a 6-month membership to the Dave Rubin Show.
Competition would start kicking in.
That's right. And we're going to do that. We may do that for, you know, couple of months. It's going to cost some money. It's going to cut into the college fund for the kids. But
I'm sorry, Myla.
I'm sorry,
I had to
sweetheart.
Terrorize this moron, yeah, yeah. Dave Rubin. But no, he was look, so look, stupid. It listen, was so fun. It helped Dad's algorithm.
Listen, I'm not going to.
I read the NetSuite crushing the competition.
That anybody does anything other than enjoy the show, get in there and leave some comments. And if they're positive comments,
yeah, build
great.
Community.
Build some
build community.
Now, look, there's also been talk that what will happen is people will join his Discord or whatever it is and be like a sleeper cell and, you know, just inhabit there for a couple of weeks or months and then start doing it. And look, I understand. I don't think this is going to be a problem. A lot of people have said to me like, oh, but wait a second. If Dave thinks there's a bunch of people in his Discord that are actually like trolls, he's going to have a trigger hair finger to ban people who criticize him at all. And that he could get confused. He could actually be banning some of his own fans. And
hello.
I just don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, he's banning them for freedom of speech. I mean, do we think if trolls are cheap, do we think this community costs more or less than a billboard in Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, the billboard, I think, already happened in this instance. It
that's
would
what
be
I'm saying.
But let's just to give you a sense of Dave's emotional state with regards to the Reddit. I think this exchange that I just sent you guys between James Damore innocently questioning Dave Rubin and Dave's
now
response.
James Damore is
the Google guy.
The Google guy. And were they on it? Was Damore on his show?
Yes.
Okay.
Check this out. First 13 seconds.
Yeah, I saw your subreddit and they seemed sort of angry. I don't know.
Well, I don't even want to get into that. That wasn't my own thing. All right,
oh, really?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Hey.
Man, warning, content's under pressure.
The bullfrog on YouTube.
This is bullfrog, the very talented bullfrog.
Oh, that was all the way from January.
That's who did the MR Fun mix song.
I think he was trying to
That's
do the Ferris
Bueller.
That's
a good beat to sample.
Oh, wow.
All right, and since we're on the... are we going to let this go a little more? Is there any more to that? No, I think that's it.
Anyways, can we talk about the complications of Hitler now? I'd like to talk about Hitler now.
And how he doesn't get enough credit for the Autobahn.
He doesn't get enough credit because a couple weeks ago there was this woman, Marianne Williamson, saying that slavery was so bad. I was like, well, that's kind of offensive to the Holocaust. But now I'd like to take the other track and say maybe Hitler did some things that we need to talk about.
Now, let's talk about the new strategy of the left. If you believe Kevin Sorbo, what's going to happen is the Antifa is going to take over everywhere and is going to drive everyone out of the suburbs and they're going to have to take their weapons.
Hell yeah.
Ben Shapiro, the intellectual pillar of the new right in this country. We get one of these every 3 or 4 years. They just cycle through. Ben Shapiro announces to the world, based upon the Daily Wire's piece, this is his outlet, Walmart caves to far left, stop selling ammo and guns. And interesting that they perceive it to be the far left. You know, I think there may be probably a broader audience that is a little bit upset at the mass killings that have taken place in Texas just in the past couple of weeks or all around the country. But I will credit conservatives with, at the very least, not wanting their children to be shot or their family members to be shot. Sometimes the calculation that they're willing to, you know, increase that risk by allowing for guns doesn't make much sense. But nevertheless, I don't think they're happy about it. And so Walmart has responded in the marketplace, right? I mean, when we talk about the marketplace, when anybody talks about the marketplace, this is supposedly the wonder of the market. If your consumers don't want you to sell something, they're going to express it in multiple ways. And you make a decision. Is it worth my while? I mean, in fact, all the libertarians will tell you there wouldn't be any racism if we didn't have a Civil Rights Act, because people would boycott those lunch places that don't serve black people. Now, of course, in practice, we know that's not the case. What happens, when Chick-fil-A funding anti-gay organizations, there was a lot of people who rallied and specifically went to Chick-fil-A. But nevertheless, Ben Shapiro has a problem with what's going on with Walmart. He says the left has found a new way of implementing policy from the top down. This policy presumably is we don't want big box stores selling guns without the use of government. Simply pressure massive corporations to do their political bidding. Now, I don't know if there was a boycott here or what. He goes on to say this is a dangerous precedent and adds to the continuing polarization of the country. Are we now going to have politically segregated big box stores? Now, what's fascinating about both of these tweets is he perceives pressure on massive corporations as a national policy on some level. It's really just one store that is not selling stuff. It is a corporation deciding it's not in their best interest to sell these baby killing machines and these people killing machines to people. It's a dangerous precedent. Now, can we look up what precedent means? Can we look up what precedent means? Because I'm curious. Precedent, I thought, meant... Let me read this. It says, an earlier event or action that is regarded as an example or guide to be considered in subsequent similar circumstances. In other words, when he says this is a precedent, that would be, this is the first time that this has happened, and it's going to end up being something that happens in the future. That political groups are going to pressure businesses to do something that reflects their values. Let's see. Can we Google it before we even get to this this era? I want to just go the let's see. Okay. Let's Google conservative boycott from what's the most recent one? Like just today, if we were to just Google conservative boycott. Let's see, we got a brief history of bad shit conservative boycotts. Boycott list for conservatives. Boycottleftwingers.com. That's an actual website that has a list. Go, click on that. Let's see what we get here. Okay, this is updated. Oh, this is as recent as... Here, slide it over. I can't see the thing. Can you slide it over? Here we go. Okay. We have, they haven't done anything since January of 2019. Added Gillette for their man-hating commercials. Added Nike for honoring Kaepernick. Added In-N-Out Burger to the support list. Added MasterCard to the boycott list for attempting to silence conservatives. Added Publix to the support list. Waffle House removed from the support list because they're gun-free policy. Coolers added to the boycott list. Yeti coolers. Adidas added to the list for supporting an American hater. Ace Hardware moved from boycott to support.
I don't know that I call myself an American hater.
Now, this is weird because based upon the definition of precedent, we're actually going back in time to establish this as a pattern. Can we go back to the Google list? Maybe this is just something that's recent and it's so close. Let's go to January 2011 to January 2016. Conservative launch boycott of Mozilla after gays press CEO. I don't even know what the rest of that is. Freedom from Facebook wants conservatives to boycott. Conservative groups call for a national boycott of Girl Scouts. Five corporations that should be blacklisted by conservative rights town hall in 2013. That's weird. Boycotted advertisers mad as hell stop fake news back in 2015. Why conservatives shouldn't boycott Chipotle. They must have been boycotting Chipotle. A conservative op-ed promotes a boycott of a 147-year-old student newspaper. There you go. Wait a second. Let's just go back in time even to 2006 to 2010. We have boycott movement against Jim Crow streetcars. Oh, that's not bad. Christian conservative boycott of Disney back in the time. GM bailout triggers calls for boycott from the conservative right. Why I'm done with Whole Foods. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. The idea that in some way it's a precedent for people, and there was no boycott for Walmart. It was just pressure.
And who is he defining as the top in that? I feel like we might need to look up what that means too.
The top would be,
like,
of course,
down
the power. And I guess he's saying that Walmart consumers are the elite in this country who are forcing this change. There you go. Once again, the pillar of the intellectual right in this country, Ben Shapiro shows,
it's not going to cut it.
Yeah, you dropped the ball on that one a little bit. Oh, and this lastly, let's get to this clip, and then we'll just take some IMs and get the heck out of here. Fox News, Fox and Friends, they want to promote this notion of basically, I don't know if this is like a Kevin Sorbo movie pro tie-in, but they're talking about how everyone is outraged by this sort of rash of attacks on the New York Police Department. People are throwing milkshakes at them and dairy products. They can't go anywhere without it. This is just, and it's because the Democratic Party is promoting this. And of course, New York is a pretty heavily Democratic state. And that's why this must be, one would imagine this would be completely rampant, where people are just like, for no reason at all, just go throw a milkshake at a cop day.
Bill Clinton, by the Clinton Global Initiative, he was like, Ungawa, black power.
And so Fox and Friends
at these pigs
assembled a whole studio full of New York City first responders because they care. Except, of course, when the Republican Party was standing in the way of funding the 9/11 Victims Fund.
Don't get greedy.
But
first responders, that's such a good umbrella term to include the cops with
right.
People we actually like.
Yes. There's people who save people from buildings that are burning, and there are people who go and harass kids on the street. But nevertheless, they assembled all of them in the studio. And they really wanted to drop the bomb. We're going to show America how horrible the Democratic Party is by encouraging all these people to pick on first responders. Here is Steve Ducey. They always give Ducey the job because he doesn't care at the end. He's like, whatever. I can't even believe I'm here.
Can we see the hands of the people here today, the first responders in law enforcement, who have encountered anything like that in the last year or so in New York or wherever you are?
Hit with water, hit with milk, disrespected, taunted.
All right. Or know anyone that has?
Well, that's good. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit.
Yeah, let me tell you what that's generally. Good. Let me tell you what was good about that. No one raised their hand. There was one dude far in the left-hand corner. Can we see him? Like, right. If you look in far in the left-hand corner, sort of like half-heartedly. Wait, aren't we supposed to raise our hands? And there was nobody else. No, it's been fine.
I saw a very rude Twitter comment once.
Yeah. Aren't we supposed to, aren't we, didn't they?
The guy told me not to slam the suspect's head against the roof of my fucking car. I felt very threatened by that.
It's funny how Ducey tries to save this, though.
People want to fire Officer Pantaleo. That triggers a PTSD response in me because I could have just as easily been being the one choking out the fat black guy. So there's a lot of intense emotional imagery in the job. So I'm going to raise my hand on that.
Wanted.
All right. Here's how he tries to save it. Like, he gets faced, and then he tries, well, let's see if we can get something that's even vaguely remotely relevant to the spot that we've used to lead this in.
In New York or wherever you are.
Hit with water, hit with milk, disrespected, taunted.
All right. Or know anyone that has?
Do you know anybody that has? Have you heard any stories? Did you hear our report when we claimed it? Did you hear what we were saying 20 seconds ago? And nobody? Okay.
Well, that's good. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about just generally. Who would like to talk on TV right now? I would imagine everybody. Where's Gerard? Gerard's over here on the end. All right, Gerard.
There we go. Yeah, anybody want to talk about this? No, I just, you know, they told us we had to come here, so. We're getting paid, so, you know.
Not really. I mean, you know, because you look at someone like Pantaleo, you go, you know, there before the grace of the Blasio go I.
Right. Yeah, no, the police union told us it was important to come to crap on de Blasio, but I don't have any stories. I just, you know, just want to say I was on TV, so.
Yeah. One time this woman was telling me not to drag a kid off of the squad car. The yelling was so loud it might have like hurt the eardrum or whatnot.
That was
traumatic.
There was a week where I had to say like, what? What did you say? Yeah. I couldn't hear you. Okay. So there it is. Yeah, no. Move on, Chief.
Show's over.
Yeah, show's over.
Show's over, Ducey. Yeah.
Appreciate your work in making sure that Mitch McConnell signed off on the first responders bill. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for running interference for that. All right, let's go to the IMs, and then we're going to get out of here. Worcester Polychronopolis. That is a joke on the Worcester Polytechnical Institute.
Well, it's for the real Worcester heads out there.
Yeah. Kevin Sorbo is currently famous for the God Is Not Dead film series, along with fellow superhero Dean Cain. But more importantly, are you stoked about the Boss Sox moving the farm team from Rhode Island to the taxpayer-funded stadium in Worcester during the offseason? This has been a big struggle for me. Because, yes, I'm psyched. No, I don't think there should be a taxpayer-funded stadium. They just don't. But yes, I would be lying if I didn't say that I'm not psyched about the Paw Sox
becoming. Games.
Unfortunately, they're going to be called the Woo Sox. They should be the Woe Sox, but apparently they're calling the Woo Sox. I don't get it because they don't want to say whoa. Dumb.
Not good. Bad team.
People call it the Bo Sox.
Bad marketing. I mean, you know what? You're totally right.
We'll call them the War Sox.
We should get to some more IMs.
JJ Cool. I want to point out that innovation isn't something that only comes from the private sector and is a key difference between Sanders and Warren. Warren's worldview defaults to the market first, while Sanders recognizes the problematic nature of market first solutions. I mean, I think that's accurate. I think that's accurate. I mean, and I don't think, obviously, Sanders doesn't believe that in everything. I mean, he's not calling for the nationalization of everything. But I think it's just a question of in what instances are eliminating markets relevant. And I think in the context of delivery, I don't see why you wouldn't nationalize. Because there's not necessarily a ton of innovation that has to go into that, as far as I can tell. Maybe there is, but maybe in the last mile, you know, there's an argument as to how it gets into the houses, but I don't see that. And I can see maybe in the first mile, like we have a new technology in terms of solar, or we have a new technology in terms of wind. It's conceivable to me. I don't know that industry well enough. But in terms of like the pipes that get to the house, I guess you could argue that it's so heavily regulated that it's that there's really not a lot of stuff that's going on there. But, you know, why don't we just get that profit? Why don't we just kick that profit back into society? Certainly the infrastructure all seems to me to be have paid off, at least in terms of that stuff. And but I also think that there is an argument that that is a second order problem. I don't know that you would get is if you, this is based on the assumption that you would eliminate fossil fuel sourced energy, that I don't know that you're going to get any significant beyond that. I don't know that you're going to get any significant value in terms of climate change to nationalize, places like National Grid. Ad hominem. Sam, since you and Michael are never going to do your basketball game or boxing match or whatever it was, yes, we will. You should do a competitive eating match. Sharpling was recently talking on the best show about you and Benjamin thinking about doing 1 year ago, and I think you probably tie in a sponsor for it, Blue Apron Presents or whatever.
Why would Blue Apron want to sponsor such a disgusting show?
Yeah, I don't think so. If Jeremy Renner's app couldn't last, there's no way Dave Rubin's will.
Well, you were saying that yesterday, Matt.
All Dave Rubin is talking about developing is what Kyle has developed for us.
Right.
It's fans.fm with like an add-on for a forum. That's all.
Fans.fm with a terms of service agreement that you cannot disagree with.
But you just have a moderator that basically says we're going to fire you.
Oh, Kyle Kashev is going to be moderating the chat for any language or anything insulting to me.
That's the weekend hashtag, Matt.
Trainboy's got a good point here.
Matt has a weekend hashtag.
Yeah, Dave Rubin's TOS, Dave Rubin's terms of service. Yes. So hashtag Dave Rubin's TOS, and you can suggest your own clauses that should be in the terms of service.
But listen, I want to make something clear. If you on that hashtag Dave Rubin's TOS, which he'll probably end up seeing, all I can say is just be careful about saying that there's some type of, you've heard of some type of rumor about people who are going to buy into his thing and be sleeper cells, because that's going to make him very nervous and uptight about the whole thing, and it's going to expend a lot of resources
go
on
easy.
His part. So please
just
please,
go easy.
Don't want him to worry.
Train boy, I wonder if Joe Kennedy will face the same wrath from the DSCC that insurgent candidates are promised when the primaries, when he primaries Ed Markey from the right. No kidding.
Vote for Ed Markey. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Vote for Ed Markey.
Shouldn't even be close. Pajama boy. Hi, Sam. I represent a prominent Christian film company and know you've been looking for work since Bob's Burgers keeps giving you the shaft. We've been trying to break into a new genre with Christian horror and want you to star in our first film where aborted fetuses come back to kill the mothers who aborted them. Jesus.
They're not going to do that. That's a woman's choice, and Sam's the nevish doctor.
Right.
Those fetuses won't come back. You just relax and get your abortion. Oh, no. I love giving abortions because it's empowering to women. Ow!
Colin from Nebraska. Sorbo's, I didn't even want to go down that road. Sorbo's last film, Let There Be Light, was gold. It's every suburbanite's manifestation of an atheist liberal. A divorced author became an atheist due to God taking his precious baby boy from him. He has a black woman publicist, a Russian girlfriend, and a gay British assistant as well. Sorbo's character sees the light after a drunk driving accident and reconnects with his wife, who arranges a meeting with a former wise guy turned pastor, Pastor Vinny. Pastor Vinny illustrates how Jesus was whacked and is our savior. The movie ends with a Hannity segment where the entire Christian community shines their cell phone screens toward the sky so everyone else can see the light.
We got to see this.
Yeah.
That
I think we could do a Twitch streaming.
Ooh, yeah, we
should
stream
Twitch
it.
That, man. That sounds incredible.
Beto, will you look that up, Brendan?
For about five
Let there be
minutes.
Light. Hey, Sam, it's Beto. I'd just like to say you laughed when I asked you to join my campaign, and now your precious Tulsi is gone. Yang is next, then Bernie. Maybe if your viewers ask nicely, I'll make Warren my VP. Beto 3.0.
Oh, my God. Just give up and move into my basement, please.
Rube Davin, are people upset about the 2016 rigging, also upset about losing money in casinos? David Feldman's soundboard. People do need to remember that over 300,000 registered Florida Democrats voted for George W. Bush in 2000. Hypnotic Jeans. What was the name of the song before the Dave Roberts interview?
Oh, it was Them Changes by Thundercat.
Binder Dad, thanks for the shout out and shofar on Tuesday. I'm cured. Wow, that was easy. Dingo ate my baby. Matt, I agree that the terrestrial origin for unconventional flying objects is a possibility. I think it's possible the universe doesn't need more than one planet with conscious beings and we're it, but I think it may underestimate how astonishing a terrestrial origin would be and overestimates the same for extraterrestrial origins. Either way, something amazing is happening with potentially world-changing implications if made public.
Yeah, let's see it.
Ben Shapiro, puberty blockers. I've noticed that Michael Brooks is a contributor on the MR page, but he calls himself a co-host a lot on your show and on his own.
Right.
What's up with that? That's a good question.
Well, I am literally a co-host. I host on Thursdays. Boom.
There you go.
I think logic. I live with like the rat community in this audience.
We've believe me, we've joked about that quite a bit when your absence before anybody ratted you out.
Okay.
Champagne communist
happens in absence, Sam. That's true.
TV show recommendation: Vikings on Amazon Video. May the gods bless the Majority Report. Sebastian Gorka's pain-free back. Listening to Matt's podcast on Rucker Bregman, I heard him mention Wolfpack and how a constitutional convention could be overrun by conservative ideas. I heard this, yet Zank is adamant that you would only vote on one thing. Any clarification? It is my opinion that Zank is wrong, that the three or four constitutional professors, some of whom were quite esteemed, who have opinions on this, but it has no bearing as to what could actually happen in this situation. I mean, you know, I was out in front of the Supreme Court adjacent doing interviews when they were looking at the ACA, and I spoke to half a dozen very prominent constitutional law professors who were talking about the ACA case, and they all thought the idea that you couldn't force states to expand Medicare, Medicaid in the way that they did, was laughable. Like, they literally said, like, eh, then there's this part, but that would be crazy. And so you just don't know in this environment with a conservative dominated Supreme Court and also legislatures that are, you know, some that are going to sign on are going to be dominated by Republicans, which way it would go. That's the only thing. I just don't think it's a slam dunk. I think it's very dangerous to open up that. Gabe in Iowa, the end of that Dave Roberts interview was such a bummer. All of that, look how inefficient this government is. Do you really want them taking stuff over as pure libertarian garbage? I guess that's what we should expect from Vox at this point, but still. Well, but no, I think the idea is, I mean, from his perspective, and I think there is something to be said about this. I mean, I don't see where there would be an ideological frame to this, but I could see it possibly. There would be an attempt to privatize it. But I think the idea is that you see what Donald Trump is doing to the EPA. There's an argument that you wouldn't want a Donald Trump to be able to control this stuff. But I think if you set up an agency in such a way that it's doing it, I don't know if the Department of Energy is being... the way that we're storing nukes is being, well,
I mean, that's just, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but, secret identity politics. There's a great Christian movie on YouTube called The Life Zone featuring Robert Loggia. It's a pro-life horror movie and it's free to watch. That evangelical Christianity is poison, but their movies are the funniest things out there.
There won't be any problem. You just have that abortion. It'll be great.
Brandon, you guys should add a Bernie drop to the rotation of sound drops. Maybe make something a little sassy. Lulu Livre, thank God Schultz dropped out. No kidding. All right, three more. Christian in Chicago. That's just a link. We'll do three more. Winnipeg Craig. Sam, you're running out of time to cover the Manitoba election. It's this Tuesday. The race is going to come down to a race between the NDP and the Conservatives in Winnipeg suburbs. Cross your fingers and remind your numerous Manitoba listeners to get out and vote NDP. A square. Matt, let me echo John from San Antonio. Kudos on the deep archive selection. These were Brendan's. The review of Obama 2004 Dem convention speech was apropos also for the partial mirage that we were served, that we were all so hungry for that hopey changey thing. Sam, great interviews and thread last week. Thanks for giving us great content. Did you see Tim Carney piece on keeping racists out of the Republican Party? I saw the headline. I meant to read it, but I was just like, oy, oy, oy. You know, that's the worst thing to look at when you're basically, you know, listening to a podcast on the Civil War. Like, you realize. Barney Sandals, huge props to Bill Burton for still grifting the hell out of Howard Schultz, class hero. And the final I am of the week. My kid Teddy, whose progress I've shared with Sam over the years as he is the same age as Mila, is also 2 days into high school, coincidentally nearby the MR headquarters at Brooklyn Arts High School. Oh, that's great. Time flies, Sam. How is your daughter doing so far? So far, looks good. Those Red Dawn bits with Marin were great then, are even more not wrong now. See you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot bright. I get somewhere the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive,